Crop FM, Ausgabe Nummer 525. Wir schreiben den 3. Mai 2024. Mein Gast heute Abend ist Robert Guffey und Titel der Sendung ist Invisible Mindfucks. Wie immer gibt es auch heute den CropCom, jenem Live-Chat, mit dem man sich an diesem Gespräch beteiligen kann. Einfach Fragen reintippen und ich gebe sie dann vor allem im hinteren Teil der Sendung sehr gerne an meinen Gast Robert Guffey weiter. Und natürlich gibt es auch die Skype-Leitung, also einfach auf der Startseite auf dieses Icon klicken oder User CropFM anrufen und all die Fragen stellen, auf die ich nicht komme. Von wo auch immer man diese Sendung hört, ein Besuch auf der CropFM Website, deine Pflicht, cropfm.at. Dort findet man einen Link zum Newsletter zum Beispiel, kann ich sehr empfehlen. Findet sich in diesem ersten Satz, in dem eigentlich alles Wichtige zu finden ist. Dort ganz oben über das Briefchen-Symbol kommt man auch zum Mail-Link. Es gibt RSS-Feeds für die News und fürs Archiv. Eben ein vollständiges Audioarchiv. Ich freue mich natürlich über Verlinkungen, die da direkt auf Sendungen gemacht werden. Wenn Sendungen verlinkt werden, bitte, bitte die aus dem Archiv auf cropfm.at verlinken, nicht irgendwelche YouTube-Uploads. Damit habe ich nichts zu tun. Wem die Sendung gefällt, weitersagen. Je mehr es hören, desto lustiger. Vor allem am nächsten Mal dann. Dann gibt es wieder Lagerfeuer bei jeder Sendung natürlich. Und natürlich gibt es den orangen Button mit dem Herz, den cropfm-Spenden-Button. Die Sendung ist ja, die Website ist komplett ohne Online-Werbung. Es gibt nur hier und da ein paar Amazon-Links, so wie zur heutigen Sendung wieder. Großartige Bücher von Robert Guffey, siehe auch vorige Sendung. Und ja, der orange Button mit dem Herz. Ganz großes Danke an alle, die den CropFM-Spenden-Button schon verwendet haben. Coverbild wie immer von Matthias Töpfer. Er ist seit mehr als 40 Jahren freiberuflich als Grafiker, Illustrator und Fotodesigner tätig. Und er gestaltet und produziert Videospots, Animationen etc., Buchtrailer, Erklär- und Industriefilme. Und mehr von seiner großartigen Kunst findet man auf atelier-töpfer mit oe geschrieben.de. Matthias Töpfer, der Illustrator. Dämonen, Besessenheit und Exorzismus in der Geschichte Österreichs. David Garcia im Gespräch mit Dr. Nicole Bauer und Professor Gerhard Ammerer im Rahmen des Anomalistik-Podcasts. Von der Frage, was Dämonen denn eigentlich sind, über Kennzeichen einer Besessenheit, bis zur Frage, ob Exorzismus vielleicht auch als Heilmethode aufgefasst werden kann und der Wunderheiler Johann Gassner im 18. Jahrhundert vielleicht bereits eine frühe Form der Psychotherapie praktizierte. Zu hören ist das Ganze auf anomalistik.de. Sehr spannend. Straße der Fortiana. Auf diese Straße begab sich Wladyslaw Raab. Sein Weg führt ihn im gleichnamigen Artikel, erschienen im UFO-Skriptorium auf die Westbury Street in Sheffield, UK, die seit den 1970ern Anziehungspunkt für UFOs, schwarze Phantomhunde und Geister ist. Zu diesen gesellte sich 1997 ein anormaler Rumtreiber, der aber auch schon in den 50er Jahren unterwegs war. Eine schwarze Gestalt mit rot leuchtenden Augen, die Passanten auflauerte, sie erschreckte, um gleich darauf zu verschwinden. Nachzulesen im UFO-Skriptorium. Ja, und hier geht's gleich weiter mit meinem Gast, Robert Guffey. My guest tonight is Robert Guffey, and we're gonna talk about invisible mindfucks. Don't touch that dial. My guest Robert Guffey is a lecturer in the Department of English at California State University, Long Beach. His most recent books are Cryptopolis and Other Stories, Dead Monkey Rum and Operation Mindfuck. He is an outstanding connoisseur of the weird and the highest strangeness there is, and he's also very aware of actual conspiracies playing out every day. Hi, Robert.
Hello, thank you for having me on again.
Oh, I'm very happy to have you on, and read a couple of new books in the meantime, and yeah, outstanding as always, and I think we're going to have a good time here today. But maybe first, are you a 33rd degree Mason yet?
Not quite yet.
Not quite yet.
I'm still a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Freemason, which, by the way, that actually ties into something. I recently wrote an article for Salon. This was back in August of last year. The title of the article was QAnon's Weirdest Obsession, Why Does the Radical Right Fear the Masons? And the whole purpose of the piece was to sort of shine a spotlight on incidents of right-wing assaults on Masonic lodges all over the world. And it's not something that a lot of people have talked about, not in the mainstream media, at least. But 3 days after the article was published, something really strange and interesting happened. A reader of Camellio sent me a link to this, like the king of all kooky QAnon websites called worldcrimesyndicate.blogspot.com. And I go there and I see there's a photo of me. You see a bunch of photos of what look like, who look like they could be billionaires. And under the heading Cargill Macmillan Masons, you see a photograph of all these old white men dressed in expensive clothes who look like they might conceivably be billionaires. Then if you scroll down the page a little bit, you'll see a photo of me. Then the photo was taken from my own website where I'm wearing this bright blue Spy versus Spy t-shirt from Mad Magazine. I've got this goofy expression on my face, and I'm holding up a copy of Camellio. And according to this guy, I'm also a billionaire and a high-ranking member of an evil world crime syndicate. And apparently one of my fellow criminals is receiving my cut of the gains because I have to get up and work every morning. But according to this guy's blog, this QAnon guy, it says the propagandist author Robert Guffey is a Scottish Rite Freemason and agent of deception of these Scottish American billionaire clans. So I'm also a billionaire, according to this guy. The Macmillans of Scotland founded Macmillan Publishing, which publishes books for educational propaganda. Another Scottish family, the Collins, are publishers with their HarperCollins, which is now owned by the News Corp and the billionaire Rupert Murdoch. The Murdochs are of Scottish ancestry, and they are managers of the Scottish Rite in the United States, which I have never heard of. Robert Guthrie is a Scottish Rite Freemason from California who specializes in architecting gang stalking and selling books about him gang stalking a guy who he claims is his friend in the book.
Oh,
Guthrie also spreads military propaganda, and he is a brainwasher.
Oh my God.
I'm planning on using this as a blurb on my next book. It'll be on the back. It'll say, you know, Guthrie is a military propagandist and brainwasher, you know, some crazy nut on the internet, you know. I'm surprised I haven't gotten a sweetheart deal from Macmillan or HarperCollins to publish one of my propaganda books. I want my cut of the proceeds. Since I'm a member of this evil criminal syndicate, I want my fair share.
Yeah. But
this goes, you know, this guy's a digital warrior, you see.
And
by
I
the way,
was
Michael
fooled
Flynn,
too. Yeah, I thought you're an English teacher and you're an honest guy, but no, you're a billionaire who has stalked your drug addicted friend.
I like how so he gets everything wrong. It's clear that he hasn't. He probably never heard my name until he saw the Salon article, because his cell phone is probably like set on Masonic mode or something, and he gets all the Freemason articles. So he's reading an article on Salon, sees that I'm the writer. I'm a 32nd degree Freemason, therefore I must be part of the billionaire clan. And then he just immediately goes to his website and takes a photo from my website, puts it up there, and then reports on this as if it's like objective reality, you know. But that's the situation we find ourselves in. In Camellio, I wrote about how my friend Damien was getting gang stalked.
Yeah.
And of course he gets it completely wrong, where he says I'm the one gang stalking.
How can you even get it that wrong? I mean, you can't be that stupid. Can you? Or maybe because you just spend like 5.3 seconds investigating anything you put out, yeah. Then you could get it that wrong. And of course Camellio, we talked about it in our last show. I have linked it up. I listened to it again, by the way. Took some notes that maybe we get to tonight. And it's just a fabulous book. And no, you're not the one who is stalking Damien. It's, I don't know, somebody else, lots of guys, who knows. And yeah, these are the things we're going to, yeah.
Well, I think that it's, this is sort of like the connective tissue between Camellio and my Operation Mindfuck, which are published by the same publisher, because Camellio, it's all about one guy getting gang stalked, and now it's evolved to the point where everybody's getting gang stalked. It used to be that they would have to like pay people to go and stalk other people, but now you can get people like this who see themselves as quote digital warriors, which is a term that Michael Flynn created. Michael Flynn was Trump's, truth seekers. Yes, yeah. Absolutely. So they'll go and they'll just stalk people online or in the real world totally for free because they don't even have to pay them.
No.
Because they think that they're doing, you know, the work of God.
Yeah, of course. Of course. What else? Well, you are a very brave guy, I think, because you're calling out fake conspiracies while pointing out real ones. So you get the worst of both sides. So you get that's how it is. You get all the hate from the QAnon guys because they think you're a freaking traitor. You're a baby eating Mason who has billions and billions and nothing else to do than stalking challenge people, and on the other side you call out real conspiracies, I mean like MKUltra, whatever, a lot of examples, for example in cryptoscatology that we covered quite in length in the last show. And yeah, I'm sure you don't get a lot of love for that neither.
Yeah, right. It's interesting. I read there are some people who have read Operation Mindfuck, but they haven't read Camellia. So I read one review. It was from a college professor who said, I just read this interesting book, Operation Mindfuck by Robert Guffey. I recommend everyone read it. And he goes, I had a student come into my office, and he said that he was being surveilled and harassed by people. And he said, I didn't know how to break it to him that he was clearly either hallucinating or having some sort of mental breakdown. And so he suggested people read Operation Mindfuck to get to the bottom of these kind of fake conspiracies. And I thought, oh man, this guy obviously hasn't read Camellia. The guy who came into his office, you know, maybe he was being surveilled and harassed. You know? And so it's, some people can, they can wrap their mind around Operation Mindfuck, which deconstructs conspiracy theories, but then if you presented them with Camellia, their mind might begin to melt because they wouldn't be able to handle the idea that no, there actually are real conspiracies going on. Or the opposite, where like I appeared on a podcast called Conspiranormal, which, you know, investigates both the paranormal and conspiracy theories. And one of the comments on YouTube was, oh man, I read Camellia and I love that, but they must have gotten to him because now he's saying the exact opposite, and he's saying there are no conspiracies because he wrote this book, Operation Mindfuck. So the Masons must have gotten to him and reined him in. It's like they can't contain a nuanced view of things. You know, it either has to be everything is a conspiracy or nothing is.
Yeah, which is totally effed up. I mean, because, I mean, the truth is that there are conspiracies, obviously, lots of them, especially when you deal about UFOs and stuff like that. You get quite naturally, you get into conspiratorial fields, I would say.
Sure.
But then you have, I mean, one of the quotes that I noted here is that QAnon, so to say, weaponized the interest in the paranormal.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And in fact, you know, it's interesting what you just said about if you get into UFOs, you naturally eventually kind of wind up in an area where you're questioning official government reality and you know what the government says is true, and that sort of just naturally comes from reading about UFOs, because obviously if you think that there's a cover-up, then you're going to begin questioning all these other areas as well. I think it's fascinating that some people have gone back to the JFK assassination as beginning as being the nodal point where people started to question objective reality. You know, they started to question their own government, and they take it back to the JFK assassination. But really, you can take it back to Kenneth Arnold. And when Kenneth Arnold first saw those flying saucers over Mount Rainier in Washington, and everything the military and the government was saying was at such variance with what average people were seeing, that's really where the breakdown begins. You know, it really starts in 1947-48, and the JFK assassination is actually a kind of a late coming event in that breakdown of trust in the government.
It's interesting.
No, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say it's interesting you named those two things because I think JFK has a lot to do with UFOs, one way or the other. I mean, his brother, for example, there's even a letter. Didn't I read it that I don't know, I read so much stuff lately on UFOs, but his brother was deaf. No, yes, you, a friend of yours, had a letter from Robert Kennedy where he clearly states that UFOs are of great interest, at least to him.
Oh yes. That was my friend Walter Boart, who wrote Operation Mind Control, which was the first important book about MKUltra, which came out in 1978. Back in 2001, he asked me if I wanted to go with him to go retrieve the archives of Gabriel Greene.
Yeah, we went into Gabriel Greene. We went into the end of the into that in the last show, so maybe people can just go back and listen to that one. I would recommend the last show anyway, because we're kind of going to build on this first interview. Yeah, so he got a couple of material. Well, and yeah, go on. One of it.
Yeah, in Greene's archives was a letter from Robert Kennedy sent to Gray Barker, the ufologist Gray Barker, who wrote The Silver Bridge and They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. And it was a letter from Robert Kennedy's office to Gray Barker saying that, yes, I have a genuine interest in UFOs. It looked authentic. And it was dated like maybe a month before he was assassinated. I recently saw someone else posted a letter from Robert Kennedy's office to some other ufologist. And they said that this was like the blanket letter that he would send out to anyone asking questions about UFOs. But what I saw online was actually different from the letter I saw back in 2001. So I wish Walter had given me a copy of it. Yeah. He passed away in 2007. So I it's just a kind of distant memory in my mind, but mm-hmm. It's a strange coincidence that you should bring it up, because I just recently saw that Robert Kennedy letter online. And I remember thinking, oh, this looks different from the one that I saw. So obviously if there was a generic letter that he would just send out to anyone asking about UFOs, he must have either had more than one generic letter, or the one I saw addressed to Gray Barker was distinctly written directly to him. I'm not sure. But and of course, Jim Mars wrote Alien Agenda, and he goes into the JFK UFO connections there. And then, of course, there's Fred Crisman talking more about pre-QAnon disinformation. Fred Crisman is involved in the Maury Island UFO affair, which Kenneth Arnold investigated, and that's written about in Kenneth Arnold's book about UFOs. And Fred Crisman pops up there. Then Fred Crisman pops up again in the JFK assassination, which I think Ken Thomas writes about. Ken Thomas, who recently passed away, he was the editor of Steam Shovel Press in the 1990s, and he wrote a whole book about the Maury Island UFO incident. I think he goes, in that book, he goes into some detail about the mysterious character Fred Crisman, who had odd connections to the United States government, but pops up in the Richard Shaver mystery. He claimed that he battled Deros in the subterranean tunnels, the detrimental robots that were part of Richard Shaver's mythology. And then he shows up in the Maury Island UFO affair, and then shows up again in the JFK assassination. Fred Crisman is like one of these characters. One of these characters like Richard Doty, who will just appear in all these different situations and has a lot of disinformation to pass out to the general public.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's in broad lines what we're going to talk about tonight, about disinformation and about, mindfuck. A lot of times supported by high tech. We're also going to talk about Richard Schoengard. Oh, God, I'm sure I slaughtered that name again.
Schoengard,
who is a 33 degree Mason and who is has been working on invisibility stuff for a long time. We get up into this in the last show again. I really recommend this one to anyone who is interested in your work or listening to this show right now. And in general. Also, you point out the inability to deal with reality as it exists, and this is challenging the left and the right. So it's not really a partisan thing.
Yes. In fact, I noticed something. It was kind of interesting because I didn't intend on this, but you mentioned the Invisible Predators article. I recently published that, and I believe it was January, February of 2022. And in December of 2021, Richard Schoenger passed away. Mm-hmm. He passed away on Christmas Eve morning, and his daughter called me on the phone and told me that he had passed. I was at his bedside just a couple of days before he died. And oddly enough, Lev Berger, the physicist who worked with Richard on Project Chameleo, he passed away only 2 weeks before Richard. So they were kind of like joined at the hip in life, and then they kind of shuffled off onto the astral realms together, just died only 2 weeks away from each other. And then when Richard's daughter told me that Richard had passed away, I was in Carpinteria at the time, so I wasn't in Long Beach where I normally would be. I went over to the beach and I wrote his name in gigantic letters with a stick in the beach. And at that moment, this amazing, the most vivid double rainbow I've ever seen appeared in the sky. It was this incredible synchronicity. But so Richard passed away on Christmas Eve morning, 2021. And then the next month, Nexus Magazine published this article, Invisible Predators, in which I quote Richard. And at the end of that article, I conclude by talking about Richard's optical camouflage technology. And Richard was the first person to be awarded a U.S. patent in optical camouflage technology. I end the article by saying, with the advent of this kind of technology, which can be used not only to create camouflage or invisibility, it can also be used to create fake realities. You know, you can be convinced that you're seeing something that's not actually there.
You can
I said, with the advent of that...
I think Richard Schoenger says you can target whole areas and make people see things that are not there. And we also go into some examples that Damien saw looking out of his window, completely fake reality with three moons and stuff. But when he went outside, everything was fine. So, and no one was covering his window. You know, I mean, how they do this? No idea. But that's only the tip of the iceberg, really, isn't it?
Yeah, well, Richard and Dr. Berger, Lev Berger, gave a whole lecture at a Spa War conference. Spa War is an annual conference that's held by various members of the military get together to discuss, you know, future developments in defense technology. And Richard and Lev Berger gave a whole lecture about their Project Chameleo and how it could be used to cloak an entire battleship. You know, not just a person, not just a stationary object. And so I say at the end of the article, with the advent of this technology, it's going to be very challenging for people to know what is real and what is not real, which was one of the main themes that fascinated Philip K. Dick in his novels, you know, who wrote Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which became Blade Runner, and he wrote Total Recall and you know, The Man in the High Castle, all these works of science fiction back in the 50s and 60s, which seemed really way out there, but now seem extremely prescient because the main theme he was often examining in his works of science fiction, one of those main themes was, you know, what is reality? What is human? How can we determine these things? And so that's how I ended that article. And then I realized that the article I just published for the Evergreen Review, which is kind of a follow-up to Operation Mindfuck. It's called The Silent Civil War, The Radicalization of the Evangelical Right, where I'm talking about QAnon and MAGA and the disinformation from the far right. And I end the article by saying there's so much disinformation on the internet and elsewhere that people are going to have a hard time understanding what is real and what is not real. And I realize that unconsciously, the endings to the two articles mirror each other. I kind of ended on the same note, but one was dealing with, you know, actual technology, you know, actually being able to alter what you're seeing in reality, in objective reality. And then the other article was talking about the same issue, but in the realm of internet disinformation, disinformation in the virtual world. So if you read the two articles together, they're both sort of examining this question of what is real, but coming at it from two totally different perspectives, one in terms of actual technology and the other in terms of disinformation.
Although, I mean, I think disinformation is, in my opinion, not restricted to the right aisle of the political spectrum. I think there's also disinformation coming from the left side.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I mean, an example
just to balance
that,
things out, you know. Yeah.
Oh, sure, sure. For example, I mentioned an Operation Mindfuck. So I'll give you two parallels, one on the right, one on the left, so you could see how this Operation Mindfuck is coming from both ends of the political spectrum.
Yeah.
On the right, I talk about an Operation Mindfuck, how from the early 90s, maybe even the late 80s, you had far right libertarians were really concerned about like imminent martial law. They were concerned about this, the militarization of the police. At any moment, martial law was going to be enacted, and then all the Christian patriots would be thrown into concentration camps. Then QAnon comes along in October of 2017, and just with a few anonymous posts on 4chan, is able to flip that script entirely. And one of the main themes of QAnon was the military is the only way. That was one of the slogans. I mean, they would actually make T-shirts and baseball caps that said, "The military is the only way." And the main theme that Q was pushing was, this is the only way that Trump is going to be able to save us from the satanic Democrats is if we enact martial law. So just a few days before January 6th, I was monitoring these QAnon podcasts, and I heard several of them, like Kirsten Weldon, who's now dead. She died of COVID. And Rick Renee and his partner Gene Decode, and they were talking about how and if this was January 3rd, so this is like 3 days before January 6th, they went to on the air to say, okay, on January 6th it's going to be wild. If you see tanks coming down your street, don't go for your guns. Just let the military do what they need to do. So it was almost as if one of the main purposes of Q was to flip the concerns of these far-right libertarians so that instead of being afraid of martial law, they would welcome it with open arms. And now they were like actually calling for martial law. I see a similar flip on the left where if you go back to like the late 1980s or early 90s, the left would circle the wagons around anyone who was being censored. So if someone's attacking Salman Rushdie, no matter what, even if they hated Salman Rushdie, they would circle the wagons around him and say, listen, free speech is inviolate. And, if you don't defend the speech of someone who you disagree with, eventually they're going to come for you too. So we all have to like stick together and defend everyone's free speech, even if you disagree with it. Well, at some point between the late 80s, early 90s, and now, a different kind of Operation Mindfuck was introduced into the political spectrum. And instead now, censorship on the left, it appears that censorship is the answer to all problems.
Yeah.
And if one single person is offended by something, oh, well, we need to stamp that out, unpublish it, pretend it was never written, act like it never existed. And even Salman Rushdie just published a book called Knife, which is a memoir of him the aftermath of being attacked on stage and literally knifed in the eye. He had his eye gouged out by this guy because he read like a page of the satanic verses and decided that it was offensive and therefore Rushdie needed to die. So Rushdie's just published a new book and he appeared on 60 Minutes. And he talked about, he made a whole statement about censorship. And he actually made the same point. He said that at one time, censorship came entirely from the right wing. And we see that now. We see in Florida, Ron DeSantis, trying to ban Toni Morrison books or V for Vendetta or Gender Queer, which is a graphic novel, or books about what he calls critical race theory, to remove these things from public schools and public libraries. And in fact, there was a law passed in Alabama where if you were a librarian and you let one of these controversial books through, then you could face jail time. So that's coming from the right. But then Salman Rushdie in this statement also said the difference today is you also have calls for censorship from the left, though they claim that they're doing it in order to protect marginalized people. And as Rushdie points out, if you look at any case where censorship has held sway, any country, any situation where censorship is the norm, it always boomerangs back on the most marginalized people. So even if you're you think you're doing it in order to help people, it's not going to help anyone. Eventually, it's going to boomerang right back on you. And we've seen that already in Operation Mindfuck. I point this out that just before the election in 2020, all the Facebook and YouTube, they went and just scrubbed all these QAnon podcasters, right? They just got rid of them. And I was monitoring all these QAnon podcasts at the time, and I saw what the reaction was. The reaction was, oh, this proves that Q is correct. Why would big tech be coming after these people if Q was wrong? You know, and so the whole idea that if you just censor disinformation and that's somehow going to solve the problem, well, we saw in real time that that doesn't work. Because did that prevent January 6th from happening? No. In fact, I think it could be demonstrated that it made the situation infinitely worse. As I say, I saw in all these chat rooms leading up to January 6th the same message, which was, well, if they censored it, if they went out of their way to remove all these people from these platforms, then Q must be speaking the truth. So all it did was it made him even more pissed off. And people who may not normally have gone to Washington, D.C. on January 6th went there pissed off and angry because their point of view had been unnecessarily scrubbed from view. So there's a demonstration of how censorship often does the exact opposite of what it's intending to do. And instead of stamping out the information, it just makes people seek it out even more.
Yeah, that's a good point. So censorship is something that the left side of the aisle engaged vigorously in the last couple of years. So many, many podcasts vanished that, simply were... But they were not only political podcasts, so also people who were questioning the narrative of the whole... how the COVID situation was handled and so on and so forth. Okay, some of it was crazy stuff. Some of it was absolute legit critique. I just published, for example, a video from The Hill where I think Kopp is the name of the reporter who was, I don't know if you heard of her. And they are talking about the theory that COVID might have escaped from the lab in Wuhan, you know? And this was, for example, something that people got shut off the internet for saying that, you know? So they lost their YouTube channel just because, I can't name an example right now, but people were viciously attacked if they would theorize that, you know, it could have come from this lab, okay? And now, I mean, one thing after the other comes out that this is very likely. Let's put it that way. It's not proven yet. I have no idea if it can be proven ever. But the things that come out also about Mr. Fauci and all those dealings, I mean, there was like disinformation from both sides. I mean, and of course, if one side starts it and I have no idea which side started it, but then it just goes on and on. And so I don't even want to spend too much time on QAnon today, but of course there's an important bridge and a parallel. So, for example, you also compare the workings of a Richard Doty with what is happening in QAnon. Mimi asked the question, is Q real? I think that's an interesting question. Is Q real?
I think what is meant there is that, is there a single person name who is calling himself Q and is posting?
I guess
these
I don't
messages.
Know. Maybe Mimi wants to elaborate on that, but I guess yeah. What is real?
I would answer that in this way. I communicated with a couple of people. I was friends with a couple of people who were monitoring this whole thing as it started. I've never even been on 4chan, you know, but I have friends who were, and I have a couple of friends who were actually there when the first Q post popped up originally in late October of 2017. And they were convinced that those first initial posts was actually being posted by someone with access to the White House, because they were posting photos that seemed to be, it was around Christmas time, and they were posting photos of them setting up the Christmas display. And it seemed that the first couple of posts were probably someone who actually did have access to the White House. Now that doesn't, so is Q a real person who's posting? Yes, it started out that way, I think. And either it began as a disinformation ploy, or someone came in early on and saw that this could easily be hijacked and took it over. I call it Team QAnon, because it's clear reading the post that it's not just one person writing all this stuff. So I often refer to it as Team QAnon, because you know, I'm an English professor, I'm a creative writing professor, I'm a writer myself, I'm used to studying writing styles. And I think you can just tell that it's not the same person writing each post. So I think it was a team of people. And, you know, who initially came up with the idea, of course, that's completely unknown. But I would mention that Michael Flynn, who was the 24th U.S. National Security Advisor in the Trump administration, he served for 22 days before he had to leave. Michael Flynn has a whole history of studying intelligence. He was an intelligence officer. He's very familiar with propaganda techniques. And there was an article that was published about Flynn early 2017, and it was published in The Atlantic. And the title of the article is Michael Flynn, General Chaos. And it almost seems to be a prescient article, because there's one point where they quote Michael Flynn as saying, oh, you know what, now that I'm, you know, I want to take a more, a less public role now. And he's, you know, I want to, I don't want to be, quite out in the open anymore. So a comment like that. And then a few months later in October of 2017, suddenly Q pops up, you know, and so one wonders, it'll be interesting to see what role Michael Flynn plays if there is a second Trump administration. But I certainly think that whoever was posting his Q, and I think it was multiple people, they definitely had a background in propaganda and psychological warfare. And in Operation Mindfuck, I point out that Paul Vallelet, who's the co-author of the Mind War paper that Wim Cooper made famous by including it in Behold a Pale Horse. Mind War was a paper written in the 1980s by Michael Aquino and Paul Vallelet. And in that paper, Aquino talks about the future of PSYOPs post-Vietnam, as we're entering into a new electronic digital age. How does PSYOPs have to change with the times? And Vallelet and Aquino argue that you need to create a new kind of PSYOP where basically he says it almost works on an ESP level, And the propaganda, your propagandist has to be completely sincere and believe everything that they're saying. And if you see the way that, and the victims, the people who are being targeted, have to come to the conclusion themselves. In other words, they have to think that they've reached this conclusion themselves. They can't suspect that they've been deceived or manipulated into coming into this conclusion. And if you look at the way the QAnon posts are written, they're all questions for the most part. It's very rarely is there just a blanket statement. It's just questions. And if you answer the question yourself, it only comes to one conclusion, which is vote for Trump. That's the inescapable conclusion. But you feel like you've come to that conclusion yourself. And also, the way that they targeted people, for example, there was this woman named Radix. That was her, you know, pseudonym. And she ran something called the Patriot Soapbox, which was one of the first websites to really promote Q and QAnon. And I heard in an interview with her, a recent interview, and she said that she was amazed that Jerome Corsi, a frequent Coast to Coast AM guest and a WorldNet Daily columnist and a frequent Alex Jones InfoWars guest, Jerome Corsi suddenly slides into their Reddit thread about Q. Now, keep in mind, this is at a time where hardly anyone's talking about Q yet. It's still kind of simmering on the dark web. Jerome Corsi slides into this Reddit thread and starts confirming all of their suspicions about Q. And yes, Q is real. And Jerome Corsi is sort of guiding them and encouraging them to promote Q. And she's this woman said that later she actually met Jerome Corsi. Jerome Corsi had some sort of press conference in Washington, D.C. So Radix goes there and meets him, and he pulls out his cell phone at one point, shows her a photograph, and he says, oh, this guy is going to be the next U.S. ambassador to Israel. And she said then a few weeks later that turned out to be true. So all you have to do is just do that one time, and then that'll convince the person, oh, well, this person actually knows what he's talking about. Then from that point on, now you're on the hook. And she said that she now looks back on it and realizes that Jerome Corsi slid in there on purpose in order to take over the whole QAnon thing and encourage them to release this propaganda. But the point is that the people listening to Radix and reading the Patriot Soapbox, they're detecting her sincerity because she believes it. It's just like they outlined in the Mind War article back in the 80s, just like Valet and Aquino said, you had these people operating as PSYOP officers or PSYOP agents, but they themselves didn't know that they were PSYOP agents. They were just being sincere. And in the world of intelligence, sincerity is like gold. So you multiply that situation over and over and over again, and you see that happening with, like I mentioned, Rick Renee and Gene Decode, the two evangelical QAnon podcasters I write about in Operation Mindfuck. When I first started listening to them, I was asking myself, do they actually believe this stuff or are they just making it up? Because Gene claimed that he was in contact with these military intelligence officers who was feeding him this information, and then he would pass it along to the listeners. And at first I thought, is he just making this up? I then realized after listening for months and months, I realized, no, this guy's too dumb. He could not have made this stuff up. He does not have the imagination to make this stuff up. Somebody is feeding him this stuff and he's believing it. And so I wouldn't doubt if they were also approached. Kirsten Weldon, the QAnon podcaster I mentioned earlier, she too mentioned that these military intelligence officers had contacted her and was feeding her information, and she would pass it along to her listeners. So all you really need is just a few people like this, Jerome Corsi, maybe a few others, to go around contacting these people, feed them the information, and then they, as volunteer digital warriors, will then pass along the disinformation to all of their listeners. So basically, you only need to influence one person, And that one person will then influence thousands of people, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, depending on how many followers they have.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, it's actually quite brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you also, I think that's a quote of your book, the National Security Act and the Military Industrial Entertainment Complex. So that's where the entertainment comes in here. I mean, this is kind of a conspiracy entertainment that people engage in. But
oh, yeah.
Then suddenly...
Conspiratainment.
Yes, very nice. Conspiratainment, yeah. And you also speculate whether QAnon is almost something like a secular religion now. Now, that's a scary thought. But yeah, I guess.
Oh, yeah. There
for
is,
some, it is.
I mentioned in Operation Mindfuck that there was actually a church called Omega Kingdom Ministry. And what they would do is they would actually, in the congregation, they would discuss the latest QAnon posts.
oh, my God.
Filtered through scripture.
Oh, God.
So yeah. They would compare whatever Q was writing with scripture and say, oh, I can see how what Q is saying is reflected in, you know, in the New Testament or in Revelations or, yeah.
Yeah,
and so
I'm sure
it really was like a...
Yeah, I'm sure they always found some spot in the Bible that had some resemblance. And as you also point out, and then, you know, I'd like to move on to the invisibility stuff then, but as you also point out, there is that Q draws from many, many authors. So it basically just reuses what is out there, what is in discussion, and reuses a lot of ancient myths that have been around sometimes for centuries. And you list authors that were ripped off, so to say, by QAnon, like Louis Tackwood, Alex Constantine, Walter Bowart, that you already mentioned, Maury Terry, John W. DeCamp, Gordon Thomas, Christopher Simpson, Jordan Maxwell, Mae Brussell, Lyndon LaRouche, Dr. Peter, Jack McLamb, and so on and so forth. So it's lots of, old stories cooked up again in a new dress, so to say. And one of them is about subterranean wars and black hats and white hats. And by the way, I wrote white heads and black hats. Sorry for that. I don't know why. My spelling is just awful sometimes. but it's an interesting, it's a strange, someone just before the show pointed me out, is it heads or hats? I said, well, of course it's hats. And said, yeah, because you write both. And then I looked, yeah, I do. I will correct that. But anyway, this was something, and of course you also point out the parallels of QAnon and Richard Doty. So disinformation in the field of ufology and using UFO sightings or people's experiences to, you know, make up stories and mingle in some real stuff that's out there that then maybe is interpreted as some alien visitation and so on and so forth. It's a huge mess, obviously. And kudos to you that you try to dig through all of that with great success, as I think. And so you also mentioned the Shaver mystery and, yeah, as I said, black hats and white hats and underground wars. And the reason why I bring that up is one of the reasons why I was really interested in these aspects is since a couple of years or many years now, I have a guest on. He's an archaeologist, Dr. Heinrich Kusch, and he also talks about subterranean, folks, you know, people who lived down there, allegedly. He dug up some documents from the Austrian monarchy talking about these, talking how the high-ups, you know, in the kingdom had contacts with those subterraneans and so on. So these are really old stories. And also, as some knights fight against those who sometimes, by the way, look like reptilians. So, I mean, you can't make it up. And so I'm just bringing it up because the things that QAnon uses and that you point out are being reused again and have been, for example, also addressed by contactees in the 50s and 60s, but they go back centuries, it seems.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the things. When I published the initial five-part series for Salon about QAnon, which was, I think part one came out August of 2020, and some people, as you've already pointed out, some people have a hard time distinguishing nuances, right? And I remember one woman commenting saying, why was I making fun of John W. DeCamp, who wrote The Franklin Cover-Up? The Franklin Cover-Up is all about sex trafficking among high-ranking Republicans in the late 1980s. I said about Franklin Cover-Up was that you can see elements of the QAnon story having been derived from the Franklin Cover-Up. And then she wrote, why are you making fun of John W. DeCamp? I didn't say anything negative about John W. DeCamp. All I said was elements of his book had been used and reused by QAnon.
Yeah.
So in a similar way, you mentioned the underground wars. So when Richard Doty was, Richard Doty and his military team were gang stalking Paul Benowitz. Yeah. There's a great book by Greg Bishop called Project Beta, which is all about what happened to Paul Benowitz, where Richard Doty and an entire cadre of military propagandists decided that they needed to steer Paul Benowitz away from what he was taking, recording images of what we now know were top secret military craft. But Paul Benowitz thought that they were UFOs. So he actually reported this to the military base. And they got freaked out. Like, oh no, he's documenting these top secret aircraft. We need to do something about this.
Although they were UFOs, They just weren't alien spacecraft, but they were UFOs.
Right? Yeah, exactly. They were indeed UFOs. And Paul Benowitz thought that they were extraterrestrial in nature, and so they decided, well, it would be better to encourage him in this belief that they were ETs, because better that than have him thinking that this was actually a top secret United States aircraft. So Richard Doty was sent in to encourage him into thinking that these were ETs. So they were feeding him stories about these subterranean battles where the U.S. military went underground and actually had these like gunfights with aliens that were in the underground bases under New Mexico. You see that story is transplanted into QAnon, except they removed the aliens and they've replaced them with demons. So these people actually think that, children are being abducted by satanic Democrats, taken down into the deep underground military bases, adrenochrome extracted from them, and then the adrenochrome is then given to various celebrities and high-powered politicians who ingest the adrenochrome so that they can remain youthful forever. I mean, it's like elements from She by H. Rider Haggard. It's like woven into this and certain B films. I mentioned in The Silent Civil War that you can see elements of this story in a 1960 film called The Leech Woman from Universal, which is a black and white movie about this expedition that goes into Africa, and they find the Leech Woman, and the Leech Woman, it's this tribe in Africa, and they will hold you down and ritualistically sacrifice you, and then during the sacrifice, they will extract fluid from your pineal gland, from the base of your skull. And then once they've extracted the pineal gland, the leech woman drinks it, and then she becomes young. And then she has to continually, she then flies to LA, and she has to continually kill people in order to extract their pineal gland, drink it to remain youthful. Well, this is like the main, this is like the main element of QAnon, which says that that's exactly what's going on. Except that they say that they're extracting adrenochrome, and that Hollywood celebrities and politicians are ingesting this. And this is why Tom Hanks looks exactly like he did 30 years ago, right? So you see elements, and also the adrenochrome aspect comes from Hunter S. Thompson's book, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which was published in 1971, where there's a scene where the journalist Raoul Duke, the alter ego of Hunter S. Thompson, and Dr. Gonzo, who was based on Oscar Zeta Acosta, there's a scene where they're in the hotel room, and Dr. Gonzo, who's an attorney, says that he represented a Satanist freak, and the Satanist didn't have enough money to pay him, so instead he gave him this adrenochrome, and he says it's extracted from a living human being, and when you take this, it takes you higher than you've ever been before. And so Dr. Gonzo and Raoul Duke take the adrenochrome and then have this crazy psychedelic trip. I suspect that Hunter S. Thompson got this idea. I was reading the collected letters of Hunter S. Thompson, and in there he mentions reading Brave New World by Aldous Huxley. So I assume it's probably safe to assume that he also read Brave New World Revisited. And it's either in chapters 4, 5, 6, or 7, I can't remember which one, in Brave New World Revisited, written in 1958, that Huxley talks about adrenochrome, which is not a recreational drug, but it is an actual chemical that forms in the brain. And there's this one passage where he's talking about adrenochrome. So my theory is that Hunter S. Thompson was reading Brave New World Revisited, got to that paragraph about the adrenochrome, and it probably stuck in his head. And then later in 1971, when he's writing Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, it comes out in this crazy episode. But that's an example of how the team QAnon, they're like they're culture vultures. You know, they're like magpies. They grab like a little piece of adrenochrome from Hunter S. Thompson, a little piece of folklore, you know, for ufology from the 1980s, little element of a B horror film from 1960. You know, and they just stitch it all together. I mentioned Richard Shaver earlier. Yeah. That's another, that there were stories of subterranean battles with the detrimental robots, the Deros and the Taros. That goes back to the 40s. And just like how QAnon is a kind of interactive role-playing game where you are not just following it on the internet, you actually go out and become a part of the role play in real life, like the dude who decided to pick up an AR-15 and go to Comet Ping Pong in Washington, D.C., because he had been told that there were children in a basement in this pizza joint in D.C. because the owner of the pizza joint was a Hillary Clinton supporter. So somebody decided that we're going to pin this guy with the accusation of being a pedophile. And you had people going to the pizza joint with signs saying that he's a pedophile and he has to die. And then one guy came with a gun, yeah, shot up the place, shot into the floor.
Where the children allegedly are. Yeah.
Yeah, where the children are, yeah. So I don't know why you'd shoot into the floor where supposedly the children are being kept. And this guy was, you know, obviously arrested. And when he was arrested, he gave one of the great statements ever. The statement was something like, my intel might have been slightly off.
Slightly off, yeah.
I love how and they use military language, you know, like intel, you know, because of course they're warriors, they're digital warriors. So you see, elements of Shaver, too, in where people who were reading the Richard Shaver stories in Amazing Stories, in the 1940s, some of them would write letters and say, oh, I'm going to go on a spelunking expedition into this cave in Georgia to try to find the Daros. Then they would write in to tell them what happened. And then whatever the readers wrote in, those elements would be kind of like woven into the story. So it's kind of like this self-perpetuating mythology where the people who are interacting with it are actually helping to build it, but they don't realize they're helping to build it. So you get free content. That's another wonderful thing about it. You know, you don't have to pay like a staff of writers pretty much. You know, I mean, whoever the few members who are a part of Team QAnon, I assume they're getting paid. But you also have all these other people, these unpaid writers who are providing you content, and they don't realize that that's what they're doing.
Yeah. Now, moving on a little bit to invisibility, and obviously there are a lot of parallels here. It's all about psychic warfare, one could say. But you also point out the context. So in this article that I linked up, Invisible Predators, and I also, by the way, linked up your fascinating interview that you did with Richard Schoengard. And you also mentioned, we already mentioned Richard Shaver, but there are a lot of contactees of the 50s and 60s that a lot of people, including, for example, Linda Moulton Howe, they didn't think a lot of them. But I totally agree with you. There are a lot of very interesting statements in people. I mean, they all seem a bit crazy, but in hindsight, a lot of things that were said by people like Albert K. Bender and so on, at least they make a lot more sense than in the 50s when it first came out. And Albert Bender, he talks about subterraneans, about creatures living in cavernous cities that are able to make themselves invisible. And again, I mean, I have to point out that coming from a totally different direction, I have this archaeologist from Graz, and who is becoming quite famous in the German-speaking realm, I have to say. And he's doing, so Dr. Kusch, and he's doing a lot of research in caves, actually. He researched caves for 4 decades now. And he also came across a lot of ancient documents and statements and so on. And I mean, he also does on-the-ground research. So this is a huge story. I mean, we can't get into it. I have a couple of shows, but all in German. But yes, he does a lot of research in that regard. And a lot of those things that you mentioned from those contactees from the 50s, they somehow rang a bell, and they somehow resonate with what he found in old documents and stuff like that, and also in myth, in local myth. So he actually found a lot of underground tunnels, ancient tunnels, mind-bogglingly built all over Central Europe by going into mythologies, local mythologies. So, yeah, great stuff. But Bender, for example, he talks about those, as I said, creatures in cavernous cities that are able to make themselves invisible. And that's, I think, where it really becomes interesting, invisibility. You also ask the question, is invisibility, as Schoengard and obviously also other military contractors are investigating, is that a kind of UFO cargo cult? And I didn't know that Kenneth Arnold was, according to his words, visited by invisible entities.
He claimed that. Yes, yeah. Isn't that interesting? I didn't know that either until I started delving into all of this. I thought it was interesting that I might have mentioned this before, that Linda Moulton Howe, I heard her say once that she would not recommend reading any of the 1950s UFO books because they're all hoaxes, or the people who wrote them were crazy, you know. And I disagree with that simply because, just looking at it from a mythological or folkloric perspective, if you see a certain odd idea repeated over and over again, it takes on its own significance, even if it's not true, you know. And So I wrote this article called Invisible Predators, Strange Creatures, Secret Weapons, and Shadow Biospheres for Nexus magazine. And the main reason I wrote it was basically to bring some sort of emotional balance to the Freudian field. I've seen some people use Camellio as evidence for the claim that all paranormal phenomena, all UFO sightings, are the result of covert testing of exotic weapons on the part of the government. And in some cases, that's true. But when Damien was undergoing all the experiences that I wrote about in Camellio, he said that if he didn't know any better, he would have thought that he was either an alien abductee or the victim of some sort of poltergeist, you know, haunting situation. You know, he had missing time. He interacted with strange entities in his home. Objects were moving around, shattering all on their own. If not for the fact that he knew he was being harassed, which he certainly knew who was doing it and why, he might have wanted to get regressed to see if, you know, like an alien had gotten a hold of him or something. And in fact, a kind of truncated version of my original interview with Richard Schoenger, not the one that was in Nexus later in 2016, but the original one that appears in Camellio, a segment of that first appeared in UFO magazine in 2007. And Nancy Burns, who's the wife of William Burns, the co-author of The Day After Roswell by Philip Corso, Nancy Burns was the one who published that original Schoenger interview in 2007. And it's, maybe some people saw that and thought, you know, what's this in here for? You know, this doesn't have anything to do with UFOs, right? It's about invisibility here. But I wanted in there because I wanted in that particular magazine because I wanted people who believe they had experienced alien abductions to take a step back and at least consider the alternative possibilities. In the Mothman Prophecies, John Keel says, belief is the enemy, you know.
And by the way,
you shouldn't get locked down to.
Yeah. But, when you say that, so what you're saying actually is that some people who think they were abducted by aliens were actually abducted by someone else with high tech, i.e. visibility, technology, and stuff like that. Is that right? Am I right?
And
this is, by the way, something that Stephen Greer says since a long time. He says that most of the abductions are not done by aliens, but done by, I don't know who he is ascribing it to, but I think some covert military faction. But that's what Stephen Greer says, doesn't it?
Right. You know, I have a friend, Melinda Leslie, who is a self-professed alien abductee, and she wrote an article that you can find. If you just Google the title "Reabs, Not My Labs," REABS. It's called "Reabs, Not My Labs." She argues that a better term for my labs, military abductions, would be reabs, meaning reabductees. Because what she's saying is that in her experience, my labs are people who are abducted by the military after having experienced a genuine alien abduction. Later on, the military comes and re-abducts them and questions them, often having questions about the technology that they saw. What did you see? How was the ship piloted? You know, they're all gearheads. They want to know how the stuff works so they can play with the toys themselves. And very often, these my labs will say that the abduction by the military was far more horrific than the abduction by the extraterrestrials. So that maybe that says something about human beings. I don't know.
And we don't even know if the, in quotes, real abductions are done by extraterrestrials. We also have to say that. They could be subterrestrials for all that we know, couldn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's why Whitley Strieber uses the term visitors, because he's saying, I don't know. I don't know what they are. You know,
we don't.
They could be ETs. They could be time travelers. They could be ultra-terrestrials. They could be human beings. In some cases, it might, you know, in some cases, it's someone who's maybe suffering from a mental illness. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of different reasons for this. But I've seen that attitude of you know, that like that there are no actual alien abductions going on. There are no abductions going on. You know, it's entirely the military doing it. I've seen that taken to an extreme where people will say, well, you know, there's no paranormal phenomenon at all. And I, from my perspective, that's just as irrational as saying the opposite, you know. So for many years, there have been prominent UFO researchers who didn't want to deal with the MyLab phenomenon at all, you know. And a lot of researchers didn't want to think that MyLabs were happening because that kind of like muddied the waters.
Yeah, a lot of researchers would get, also in the German realm especially, would get very angry if you only mention it.
Yeah, well, it cast doubt, right, on the validity of the other alien abduction reports. But I think at this point, the MyLab cases can't really be ignored or dismissed because there's just too many of them. And Melinda Leslie's collected a lot of them. So for the ufologist to dismiss MyLabs out of hand would be as myopic as, you know, the more prosaic conspiracy researchers who say, don't listen to those alien abductees. You know, their experiences aren't valid. They're just victims of, you know, MK Ultra, government mind control programs. So back in 2015, I did this book signing at Skylight Books in LA. And a woman came up to me and she wanted me to sign her copy of Camellia. So I signed it, dated it, and I drew a picture of a classic, like, George Adamski UFO in front of the book, you know, like with those three balls on the bottom, you know. And the woman said, she goes, could you write underneath it classified anti-gravity aerospace craft? And I go, why? And she said, well, I don't believe in UFOs. So I just wrote classified anti-gravity aerospace craft underneath the picture with an arrow pointing at it. And she was happy with that. That made her happy. So I wanted to like set the record straight and make sure that people understood that Richard Schoengert himself, who developed this optical camouflage technology, he believed in the objective reality of UFO phenomenon. So in that 2016 interview with Richard, which was published in Nexus Magazine under the title Rosicrucianism, Freemasonry, and Esoteric Science, he talks about how his interest in optical camouflage actually came from studying the UFO field itself. He first became interested in UFOs at some point in the 1960s, and he read all these reports about how the UFOs would either like zip away very fast or would seem to cloak themselves. And he thought, you know, well, how can I replicate this effect with the technology that we have access to today? So in a way, you can say Richard's Project Camellia is kind of like the cargo cult version of UFOs. It's like, you know, pre-industrial island cultures would observe airplanes in the sky and then try to replicate them with bamboo.
Yeah.
Whatever materials they had.
So it's actually a way of imitating something that people actually experience. Because
right,
we have no idea how these beings, wherever they come from, we only know there's a presence here. I think that's pretty clear. We don't know where it comes from. We don't know what it wants. And it can cloak itself, or it can become invisible. So even Kenneth Arnold had an experience like that. And those craft can suddenly disappear and cloak themselves. So they might just zip out of our 3D space, or they might just actually use cloaking technology. We don't know. But what you're saying is that Richard Schoengert saw this, read about this and then started to think, how could you do that? And yeah, right. Human ingenuity is endless. Yeah.
And UFOs, that wasn't just the only inspiration for the idea, because he said in that same interview, he talks about being initiated into the Rosicrucians on the island of Guam back in the 1950s and hearing about these ascended masters who could make themselves invisible by cloaking themselves in a kind of cloud that could hypnotize the people around them, almost like the shadow of the old pulp hero from the 1930s. And in fact, there's a book called Invisibility, Mastering the Art of Vanishing by Steve Richards. It's an interesting book to look at. The first chapter is called The Invisibles. And in that first chapter, he talks about the Rosicrucians and their interest in invisibility. So Richard was a Rosicrucian and he was a Freemason, and he started all that in the 1950s. Then you come to the 60s and he's looking at UFOs and he kind of puts all these things together. So for decades, Richard worked at Northrop Grumman, where he had a top secret clearance. And he worked on the B-2 bomber and various unmanned aircraft, the Advanced Extremely High Frequency Program, on and on. And he worked at Northrop Grumman from, I think, the late 80s all the way till he retired in 2014. I was at his, actually spoke at his retirement party. So I thought it was kind of interesting that Northrop Grumman published an article in April of 2020 called Hiding in Plain Sight, The Argument for Invisible Aliens. And this is just a brief excerpt from that article. It says, what if invisible aliens exist among us, already here but unseen by human eyes? Astrobiologist Samantha Rolfe of the University of Hertfordshire took this idea and ran with it, exploring the possibility of a shadow biosphere capable of supporting alien life on Earth, just not life as we know it. And oddly enough, Nikola Tesla first talked about this, the same concept, in the June 1900 issue of Century Magazine. And in that magazine, he says, we cannot with positive assurance assert that some of them, meaning the aliens, might not be present here in this our world, in the very midst of us, for their constitution and life manifestations may be such that we are unable to perceive them, unquote. And that's very similar to Philip K. Dick's concept of VALIS, the vast active living intelligence system, that he writes about in his masterpiece, magnum opus, VALIS, which came out in, I think, 1981 or 82. Fascinating. And Philip K. Dick, you know, shown those many signs of perhaps having been either an abductee or a mind control victim. And in fact, his widow,
or both.
Oh, Tessa Dick. Say that again.
Or both.
Oh, yes, yes.
Philip K. Dick.
His widow, Tessa Dick, was one of the first people who interviewed me about Camellio. And she said, she had her own radio show called Ancient of Days. And she said when she read Camellio, she said, this answered a lot of questions about experiences that me and Phil had in Orange County back in the 70s. Because a lot of the stuff that Damien experienced in San Diego in 2003, 2004, Tessa Dick said she and Phil Dick experienced similar things back in the 70s. So you can kind of trace this idea way back. And in the article, in Invisible Predators, I think the earliest text I cite is Demonology by King James, which was published in the late 1500s. And it warns against these invisible beings that are supposedly malevolent demons. And I mentioned Goetia, which is the lesser key of Solomon the King. It dates back to the 17th century. And it talks about demons that can grant magicians the ability to go invisible. But in terms of the modern era, of course, there are some ufologists who think that aliens are demons, like Norio Hayakawa, believes that. The idea of invisible extraterrestrials actually popping up in some of these stories is fascinated me. And so when I came across that Kenneth Arnold story, that was like one of the main reasons I wanted to write this article, because I thought it was fascinating that you had all this like connective tissue. I don't think I need to tell your audience who Kenneth Arnold is. So, right. But he told the Saturday Evening Post in the early 50s, he said, at my home, I have been visited by unseen entities whom I believe to be pilots of these weird discs. They were invisible to me and made no attempt to communicate, but I was aware of their presence because I could see my rugs and furniture sink down under their weight as they walked about the room or sat on various objects in the room. So that's Kenneth Arnold, and then Albert Bender.
And Kenneth Arnold, maybe let's mention that for people who don't know it, he's the guy who unwillingly termed the phrase flying saucer. So basically he just said he saw those disc-shaped objects that were moving like saucers over water, if you know, I think that's how he described it. And then somehow journalist who wrote an article about it turned it into flying saucers, and that's how this whole term came about. So he was the one who so to say triggered the whole UFO craze in 1947. I mean, it would have been someone else if he didn't do it. I think it was ripe, but yeah.
By the way, there's a comic book series that's coming out now called Blue Book by James Tynion, which is quite a fascinating attempt to kind of document in comic book form the early years of UFOs, starting with Kenneth Arnold and moving forward. I recommend it. But Kenneth Arnold, it is interesting that he was attempting to describe the motion of the objects, not the shape of them, he said that they were like saucers. Yeah. Because the way he described them, they actually sound more like flying wings, like what we would later see as flying wings in the 1980s, or like half moon, almost crescent shaped is what they were actually looked like. Yeah. But in Flying Saucers and the Three Men, Albert Bender, he talks about encountering this invisible being that sat in his chair and spied on him, I guess, to make sure he didn't spill any secrets to his guest, Albert Bender's guest. Then after his guests leave, this thing reveals itself, and it turns out to be this like 10-foot-tall green creature with glowing red eyes and a glowing red face. And Bender immediately faints. And then when he comes to, the creature is gone, but it's left behind the smell of sulfur, and the rug that it was standing on is like scorched, which is fascinating because these details kind of like connect back to the demonology I mentioned earlier. You know, suddenly the occult and ufology are kind of beginning to merge together in Flying Saucers and the Three Men. Reasons why I think it's a prescient book, because when it was published in the early 60s, people laughed at it, John Keel later on in 1970, when he writes Operation Trojan Horse, there's a page where he says, you know, people laughed at Albert Bender, but if you read it now in hindsight, a lot of the stuff he was talking about has actually become almost commonplace in ufology. And I do think it's a kind of prescient text in the sense that it begins to merge the occult and ufology. Those two narratives begin to intertwine at that point. And then the high weirdness really amps up in 1963, a couple years later, after Bender publishes Flying Saucers and the Three Men. Gray Barker publishes a book by a guy named John Stewart, and the book is called UFO Warnings. It might be my favorite UFO book. Have you ever read UFO Warning by John Stewart?
No, actually, I just heard about it in your article, I think.
You got to get a copy of it. It's amazing. So the book, it claims to be nonfiction and follows the adventures of John Stewart, the author, and Doreen Wilkinson, the only two members of the New Zealand Flying Saucer Investigation Society. And John Stewart's married, but for some reason he hangs out with Doreen until like the wee hours in the morning discussing UFOs. And after their breathless discussions about flying saucers, they will often like smoke a cigarette together and then take a stroll in the moonlight. And throughout the book, he keeps insisting with greater and greater anger that he and Doreen are not having an affair. And you'd have to be, you know, a complete sicko pervo to even contemplate that such a thing was going on. And then suddenly everything takes a turn into the Twilight Zone when the two of them begin to be surveilled by these invisible entities. And one night, Doreen claims that a group of these creatures, while invisible, raped her for like 2 hours, which is interesting because it kind of presages the entity case that was investigated by the paranormal lab at UCLA in the 1970s. It was made into the film The Entity, but it was based supposedly on a true story. The paranormal lab at UCLA, which was still around at that time, investigated the case, and this woman claimed that there were these three entities that were raping her. And in fact, the entities followed her. You know, I think she moved and they would actually follow her. But UFO warning, the book is written in such a kind of clumsy, naive way that I think most people would assume it was some sort of weird, misfired attempt at writing fiction. But what's fascinating is that in 1993, there's a professor at USC named Robert Elwood, who wrote a book called Islands of the Dawn, The Story of Alternative Spirituality in New Zealand. And Elwood devotes his whole chapter to John Stewart and Doreen Wilkinson and UFO warning. And he uncovered these personal letters written by Stewart over the course of many decades that reveal that Stewart and Doreen both actually believed that something, you know, terrible had happened to them. It wasn't a hoax, you know, or it wasn't a piece of fiction. That doesn't mean it happened, of course, the way they described it, but it does mean that Stewart believed he was telling the truth, you know. So the letters reveal that he and Doreen were indeed having an affair, which is pretty obvious when you're reading the book, though Stewart goes out of his way to try to conceal that. And it also seems that Doreen might have had Stewart's baby or somebody else's baby in a private nursing home. And it really seems that Stewart spent the rest of his life in genuine terror that these invisible entities might return and track him down. It's also interesting that he seems to suggest that it was his and Doreen's intense obsession with UFOs that drew the entities to them, which is interesting because Whitley Strieber will make similar suggestions much later on. Strieber wrote a fascinating novella called The Open Doors and an anthology called Revelations that explores that idea in a kind of fictional context. I recommend that book, by the way. A lot of people forget that Whitley Strieber started out as a fiction writer. He wrote The Hunger and Wolfen, which were both bestsellers. And, you know, in the 1980s, Whitley Strieber was on the same level as Stephen King or Dean R. Koontz, you know.
The Day After Tomorrow, for example, he also wrote, together with our good old friend Art Bell.
Right, and I think they would alternate sections. So Whitley Strieber would write the narrative portions, and then Art Bell was writing the nonfiction sections, which is kind of an interesting way to structure a book.
Into a quite decent movie.
Yeah, to The Day After Tomorrow, right? Yeah, yeah. And also, Strieber wrote War Day in the 1980s, which was also a very successful science fiction novel. But some people forget that he started out as a fiction writer. When he wrote Communion, the entire like science fiction, fantasy, horror community pretty much turned their back on him, except for Dennis Etchison, who's an excellent short story writer, horror writer. Dennis Etchison, who wrote The Dark Country and Blood Kissed and Red Dreams and The Death Artist and many other excellent short story collections. I met Dennis Etchison in 2000. I had a book signing. The very first short story I ever published was an anthology called Aftershocks. And there was supposed to be a book signing in San Diego. And Dennis Etchison and George Clayton Johnson, the famous Twilight Zone writer, George Clayton Johnson, were both there. And I ended up having coffee with the two of them at a coffee shop next door for about a half hour. And Dennis Etchison talked about how he remained friends with Whitley after Whitley published Communion. And Dennis Etchison was very much a fan of Terrence McKenna, who wrote True Hallucinations and The Archaic Revival. And Terrence McKenna was very much into writing about ayahuasca and, you know, altered states of consciousness. And it was Dennis Etchison said he got Terrence McKenna and Whitley Strieber together to meet one another. And they actually had a whole discussion about the connections between Terrence McKenna's research into like DMT and ayahuasca and Whitley Strieber's experiences, which is quite fascinating because Terrence McKenna often talks about these self-replicating machine elves that would appear DMT experiences. And these self-replicating machine elves sound a lot like what Whitley Strieber is describing when he describes The Visitors. And in fact, there's a fascinating Netflix documentary called DMT, The Spirit Molecule, where they talk about this university professor who did all these experiments with DMT, and he would put two people together, or rather these two people did not know that they were undergoing the same experience. So they'd be in separate rooms, and they'd both subjects would be given DMT at the same time. And then later, the professor would write down what they said that they experienced while under the influence of the DMT. And some people would have the same hallucination, even though they didn't know of each other's existence, and they were in separate rooms at the time. So it's kind of interesting, the idea that somehow whatever experience Whitley Strieber is having is somehow paralleled in these people who are taking DMT is kind of a fascinating idea. But anyway, Strieber started out as a horror writer. And so when you read Communion, you know, it reads like a horror story. It's filled with a lot of fear. And then later, as his books progress and you read Transformation and Confirmation, the fear aspect is less. And I think it's interesting that since Whitley Strieber was a lapsed Catholic, that you have these titles, Communion, Transformation, Confirmation. These are all stages of Catholicism, you know? And so I don't know if that's, you know, was on purpose or if it was subconscious, but it ties the whole abduction experience into the religious realm at the same time. But The Open Doors, which is a story that Strieber wrote, examines this idea of that if you're obsessed with the UFOs or the aliens, that it'll actually draw them to you, which John Stewart thought was happening to him. And in fact, Strieber, I heard him say during an interview once that he backed away from UFO research or from writing books about aliens or UFOs because he actually was concerned that that he was being used as a way of promoting the idea of the aliens in order to draw them into our realm, which is a fascinating idea. I recommend reading this novella, The Open Doors, even though it's fiction. I think it's a very fascinating meditation or analysis of the abduction experience, but through a fictional lens. And then later on, you have people like Trevor James Constable and his notion that UFOs are these invisible critters living in the atmosphere, which kind of prefigures the whole concept of the RODS, RODS, which were prominent in the late 1990s, this whole idea of these like insect-like beings that you could only capture on certain shutter speeds. And Streber writes about that.
Yeah, great Art Bell shows about this, by the way. Great Coast to Coast shows.
Oh, yeah. And Streber has a whole section about the RODS in Confirmation. And also, by the way, Confirmation is an interesting book to read because Streber also kind of hovers around tackling the notion of my labs in Confirmation. He brings up that whole idea of, are there human beings involved with this entire experience as well? And then you mentioned earlier the INVOs. I touch on John Keel's writings about these things that he calls INVOs that seem to show up during UFO flap periods and harass witnesses, which is exactly what John Keel calls INVOs is exactly what Kenneth Arnold is describing. He has his UFO sighting, and then later he's visited by this invisible entity, you know. And Jacques Vallée, he mentioned something very similar in the 1970s with a woman named Mrs. Frances Victor, who was attacked by this invisible entity in her home after she had this like really dramatic UFO sighting 3 years earlier in Northern California. And I think he writes about that in Confrontations, part of his trilogy. I also quote Vallée's book, Forbidden Science 4, which by the way mentions Camellio. There's an end note in Forbidden Science 4 where Vallée actually references Camellio directly. And in that same book, he mentions a physicist named Roger Remy, who told Vallée in the 1990s about the Phillips lab at Edwards Air Force Base testing invisibility devices, what he calls the low observable and cloaking type. So Schoengert's Project Camellio paralleled a similar investigation being conducted by the military, which was something that Schoengert suspected all along, as I mentioned in Camellio. And I also mentioned something that fascinates me, and I'd like to look into this more. I mentioned the research of a woman named Donna Higby, who's a hypnotherapist in Santa Barbara, who began collecting reports of what she calls spontaneous human invisibility. And we've all heard of spontaneous human combustion, of course, which even Charles Dickens wrote about spontaneous human combustion back in the late 1800s when someone just suddenly poof, burst into flame for no apparent reason. Well, this is spontaneous human invisibility. Random people just suddenly becoming invisible and not being able to do anything about it. Higby published her findings in a journal called The Anomalist, number 3, in 1995. And she concluded that she said the people having these invisibility experiences seem to be people with higher than average psychic abilities. And she speculated they are able to traverse other dimensions and command natural forces knowingly or unknowingly. In other words, some of these people, they have these psychic abilities, and they have the ability to phase out of one dimension into another, but they're not aware of that. So they will just sort of subconsciously make themselves invisible or phase out of one reality and go into another, and they just sort of spontaneously come back, phase back into reality. But there's a whole period of time where no one can see them, and they're trying to interact with other people, but no one can see them or hear them. It would be terrifying if you were just trapped in that state forever. You know,
when I read that, I mean, I thought that's very fascinating, but I don't know. Do you think that people just stand somewhere and then suddenly they turn invisible? Is that what you think is happening here? But if that would be the case, wouldn't other people have witnessed that? And if they try to interact with the people, I mean, how does that even work? Is their clothes also becoming invisible for whatever reason? What if they pick up something? Wouldn't other people then experience strange poltergeist phenomena of cups and stuff moving through the air? Because what I want to get to is, when I read that, and this is all in your Invisible Predators article that, as I said, I linked up along with the book Operation Mindfuck. What my thoughts were is, maybe those people who spontaneously become, in quotes, invisible are actually having an out-of-body experience. And in this state, try to communicate with other people, but obviously they can't see them because actually they're lying somewhere and they're just moving around without their body. And in that sense, they're invisible. But they themselves maybe don't realize that they have an OBE. And that's the only conclusion, understandably, that they draw.
Well, you know, oddly enough, Charles Fort writes about things like, you know, mysterious, strange disappearances. And he talks about a guy named Oliver Lerch, L-E-R-C-H, in South Bend, Indiana, on December 24th, 1890, at roughly 10 p.m., while fetching a pail of water from a well, he suddenly just, like, disappeared and then never came back. So maybe that was spontaneous human invisibility, you know. And then you have like David Politis talking about missing 411 and people who disappear in the forest, you know, and then he has other books about urban disappearances. I mean, maybe that's what's going on, you know. These hikers talk about they're hiking in the woods and their friend is right behind them, and then suddenly they turn around and their friend's not there anymore, and then they're never seen again.
You know? Yeah, but then they wouldn't be invisible. They would just like be snatched into another dimension or something like that. But you know, I also do some. It's a format called Campfire, and people calling in, and I had a couple of callers who were telling stories where they would go hiking with a friend, and then suddenly the other one was gone. And although they were on the same parking spot looking for each other, they didn't see each other. And suddenly, then the other reappeared, or they were there again. So that could be spontaneous invisibility, maybe. Or they are in different realms of reality temporarily. I have no idea. But yeah.
That's fascinating. But I mean, it's similar to Richard Schoenger was talking about how in the 60s he's reading these UFO books, and he's reading about these UFOs that suddenly seem to cloak themselves. But then he thought, oh, well, what if they're not cloaking themselves necessarily? What if they're actually phasing, you know, into another dimension or into another reality? So that's not quite the same as cloaking.
Completely different, because when you cloak yourself, you're still there. So if someone would just become invisible for the rest of his life, I mean, eventually he would make himself known by throwing things around. And I mean, maybe he could still be heard, or maybe he writes stuff into the sand, you know. So I think the 411 stuff, well, unless it's not something completely different or goes in the realm of my lab, I think you also write about people who have those experiences, 411-ish like experiences coming back, having a lot of chemicals in their system, psychoactive substances that could be used to make people forget things and stuff like that. So, yeah, could be all kind of stuff.
Oh, yes. And like I mentioned, Melinda Leslie earlier. And I interviewed her for a long time one day. And she was talking about how she was a part of what she said was a mass abduction.
Yeah.
I think around 2010 in Arizona, and she's had many abductions in her lifetime. And in this case, she was staying at a friend's house in Arizona, and she claimed that she and her friend and her friend's husband and her friend's daughter were all taken at the same time. And they were taken, she claims, to an underground military base in New Mexico. So this is an example of, you know, in QAnon, you have elements that are valid being meshed with elements that make no sense or are just used as a propaganda tool, you know? So like Richard Stoddard wrote a book called Underground Bases and Tunnels, which is, I think, a worthwhile book to read, you know? So I wouldn't exactly lump that in with the QAnon stuff, you know? But Melinda, she claims, and it's important to note that there are other, you know, three other people, or actually four other people. There were five, because there was also a guest at the house who was also taken. So there were four other people who claimed that this happened, and they kind of compared notes later on. And Melinda said that at the and you know, it's like an epic it's like an epic journey of this particular story. But near the end of the evening, she said that the military guys who were kind of escorting them around gave them a little Dixie cup filled with a white fluid. And she said that this wasn't the first time she'd been given something like this. And she said it's like a white fluid. And when you drink it, she said it makes everything go away. Basically, that it suppresses your memory of the event. And then, but then later on, when they all woke up in the morning, they started comparing notes, and I said to her, well, if the fluid is meant to suppress your memory, why do you remember so much of it? Right? And she said that she thought that the fact that there were five of them and they were able to compare notes like the next morning, maybe it wasn't as effective as it would be if you were just by yourself. The fact that they were all together and then could immediately compare notes afterwards, they were able to help each other, you know, dredge up the memories of what had occurred to them. And so I was reading the stories of David Politis tells Missing 411, these urban disappearances and disappearances in the wilderness, where sometimes people will just vanish. Somebody will walk into a bar, you know, to a bathroom in the back of the bar, and they never come out again, and they're just not seen. Then later on, their body's like found in the woods somewhere. And he was talking about how in a lot of cases they found a particular substance in the bodies of some of these people. And I remember I looked it up, and one of the main like side effects of the drug was that it suppresses memory. And I thought, obviously this is pure speculation, but like, what if someone like Melinda, who's being used in some sort of my lab experience, what if something goes wrong and you're not able to take them back to where you got them from? Do you just drop them in the woods somewhere? You know, and that's why there's this substance in the body that, you know, is that the white substance, the fluid that was given to Melinda and her friends? And that night, you know, if something had gone wrong, you can't just like drop them back off at their house. You know, you just go and dump them somewhere. So that's pure speculation, of course, but it might be worth looking into. I also mentioned in the Invisible Predators article that Marshall McLuhan once said that technology is the extension of man. Marshall McLuhan wrote Understanding Media and the Gutenberg Galaxy and many other books. But he said that, you know, we built the automobile as the extension of the foot. And so the technology mimics or improves upon what our own bodies are already capable of doing. So, you know, is it possible that these extraterrestrials built their craft as an extension of their own bodies? In other words, if their craft are capable of invisibility, perhaps it's because their bodies are also capable of invisibility. That's an interesting thought as well. And even though we have these stories of invisible entities going back to the beginnings of the modern age of ufology, there's even recent examples as well. I mentioned in the article Christopher Bledsoe, Christopher Bledsoe said that he and his son encountered these entities in the woods in North Carolina in 2007, and his son was pinned down in the woods for hours, hiding from these things that were almost entirely invisible, and they were like two small beings, 3.5 to 4 feet tall, that were invisible except for they had these glowing red eyes. And when the eyes of one creature closed, the eyes of the other creature would shut, and the eyes would close from the top and the bottom to the center, like window shutters. And Chris Jr. couldn't leave the bushes because the eyes of one of them was always open, as if scanning or searching for someone. And again, that was in 2007, but it underscores the idea of these aliens, or whoever they are, being able to cloak their own bodies. And it's not just alien sightings. In 2018, I interviewed a fellow named Bob Gutowski and his son Chris. He said it wasn't just one witness. You had three witnesses. You had Bob Gutowski and his two sons. They were in the woods on the Grand Mesa in Colorado in August of 2014. And they said, Bob said to me, and this is a direct quote, he said, "Something jumped and ran between the brush. You could see it parting the brushes while it was running. You could hear it running. It gets up about another 50 feet in front of this teepee-looking structure that's about 25 feet tall. One of these teepee poles started to shake as if something was climbing it. Then the pole broke 5 feet from the top and fell away from us as if something was on it. You could watch this one branch kind of vibrate up and down like something heavy is running on it. And when it got up to, I'd say, about 10 to 15 feet up, the tree itself snaps right in front of us. It's like 10 o'clock in broad daylight and a tree branch snaps and breaks. We heard something hit the ground first, something hard hit the ground, and there was nothing in front of us. We're talking invisible. Nothing in front of us we could see. It hits the ground, and then it runs away from us. Then the bottom of the tree hits, and then the top of the tree hits." And then I said, "So when it hit the ground, something was definitely impacting with the dirt, but you couldn't see it." And he said, "There was nothing to see. You know how in Predator you could see the distortion? No distortion. It was pure, clear." And I said, "Is there any possibility that whatever it was simply hidden by the branches?" And then Bob's son said, "When you go up the hill, it kind of goes up and flattens out a little bit. So we had a clear view and something was moving, but we couldn't see it." And then his father said, "We walked up the hill and that's where I heard what sounded like two things talking, but I didn't understand the language. And it wasn't very loud. It sounded like a couple of people who were, say, 50 feet away from you whispering to each other. That's what it sounded like to me, but it wasn't in English. I've witnessed bears walk 10 feet up into the bush in Alaska and they just completely disappear. But this was different. The bear I saw was the size of a Volkswagen Beetle, but she didn't disappear like we're talking. No, bears just blend in real well. I could see the silhouette of this bear in Alaska sitting down and eating." And then I said, "So you're saying you're familiar with how a bear blends in with its environment? You've seen that, and that's not what you saw in Colorado." And he said, "Right, not even close. This was invisible. This was like you walking in your front yard with your grass and you can see footsteps running through the grass, and that's it, nothing else. You could see through everything as the thing was moving. The one thing I can't wrap my head around is people say this creature," and he's assuming that it's some sort of like a Bigfoot cryptid. He said, "This creature is interdimensional. How can something be interdimensional and have mass at the same time? I think J.C. Johnson, who's the late cryptozoologist, has it right that they can cloak themselves when threatened." So that's interesting because that's not necessarily an alien extraterrestrial sighting. He's saying that this was more like a Bigfoot scenario. But it is interesting that at one point he mentions Predator, where he said, you know, in Predator, how you can see the distortion. In Camellia, Richard Schoenger talks about, he mentions Predator. And he said that, he goes, I don't know who the special effects team were, but they did a really good job of showing how the distortion would look based on Richard's own experiences with experimenting with this technology. And unfortunately, I never got a chance to tell Richard before he passed away, because I was going to present the article to him when it was published in January, February of 2022. And he passed away on December 24th. So I didn't get a chance to show him the article. But in there, I mentioned that I found out that the guy who was the head of the special effects team on Predator was the son of J. Allen Hynek, which was like a bizarre twist, you know, that Richard says, oh, yeah, I don't know who the special effects team was. You know, this was back in 2006 that Richard said, I don't know who the special effects team were, but they did a really good job of showing this distortion. And then later on, I just stumbled across the fact that it was J. Allen Hynek's son became a special effects artist, and in fact has won, I think, Academy Awards for his visual effects, that he was the one who is in charge of the effects on Predator. That's either a coincidence, that maybe they hired him because he knew exactly what this stuff should look like. But
does Hynek at some point talk about invisible entities? Or
that's a good question. I don't ever recall that, but I think I would need to go back and like look through all of Hynek's books again in order to find that. That would be a good project to do, though. That would be a really interesting link.
Yeah.
That's certainly worth some time and effort to do that. It's interesting. I was on this show called Existence of Strange Things. It's a podcast. And the two guys who were hosting it, they told me about this story. They said, have you heard about the Glimmer Man? And I said, Glimmer Man? I go, no, I don't know what that is. I hadn't heard of it at that point. They sent me the link to their interview. They interviewed this man and a woman who had this interesting story to tell. So I sent Richard the link to the show, and Richard actually listened to it and was quite interested in it, which is why I'm telling you about it. So this is not something I like investigated, but I think it's fascinating. It was a man and a woman, and they interviewed the man and the woman separately. So they interviewed the wife first, and then the husband, and then they put the interview together. So it had almost like Rashomon effect. You're seeing the same event from two different points of view. So this woman said that she had an experience she had with her husband and children while on vacation during the summer, and they ended up on this road in the forest, and they got lost, and they were trying to figure out how to get back on the main road, and they end up pulling into a roadside rest somewhere, and the woman takes her daughter into this bathroom, and the husband goes to find the men's bathroom, and the husband sees what he describes as this invisible man climbing over a fence, invisible but shimmering, and you could see it was wearing like some kind of uniform. So it's kind of like a Predator type technology. So invisible, but you know, there's distortion. You can still see a slight outline of something. And so he sees this invisible guy climb over the fence and approach him. Meanwhile, the wife is waiting outside this other bathroom while the daughter's inside. And the wife is looking at the landscape, and she's thinking how beautiful it looks. And she said it looked like a Bob Ross painting, right? And as she got closer, she said she could see the seam. And that she realized the scenery wasn't really there. And so it was this like weird valley of the uncanny kind of effect. And she wanted to get closer to it. At that point, the daughter starts screaming and runs out of the bathroom. And she goes, oh, mommy, there's something in the bathroom. And she describes this like shimmering person that's in the bathroom with her. So at that moment, the husband comes running around the corner and he's like, there's an invisible man over here. Let's get the hell out of here. Right. And so they all get into the truck and they drive away. And the way they, I sent this to Richard. Of course, the actual interview is more involved than that, but that's essentially what happened. And I sent this to Richard and he was really interested in it. And he said, it sounds to me like there was some sort of emergency that occurred in the forest and they needed to quickly throw up some sort of optical camouflage to hide whatever it was they were doing. If it was a permanent installation, they could do it much better than that, where you wouldn't see like the seams. So it would have been much more sophisticated. And I remember the woman saying that she had this urge as the husband was dragging her away and like saying, you know, we got to get the hell out of here. But the woman had this curiosity to see what was behind that screen. But her husband just dragged her away. It's probably good they didn't investigate further, you know, because it could be the whole purpose of the guy coming over the gate and the guy in the bathroom was to sort of scare them away. Yeah. From whatever was happening there. So who knows? Maybe if they, you know, seen behind the screen, they would have ended up, you know, as an entry in a missing 411 book or, you know.
And Richard Schoengard, he talks a lot about the abilities of his technology, which is completely fascinating. So I can just recommend everyone reading the interview you did with him. So it's not just that you can cloak people, which is a great feat, but of course you can also cloak buildings, I don't know, watchtowers, whatever. And that's really interesting. And you can, as we said before, you can make people believe that there are things in a certain area that are not really there. What a great way to fake an alien invasion, by the way.
I remember now the book where Pilates is talking about the drug. I remember it was he was talking about a guy named Todd Geib, G-E-I-B, and the drugs found in the system were amitriptyline and desepramine, which are both antidepressants. And one of the major side effects of both is cognitive memory impairment and delirium and confusion. So, you know, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And I was contacted by, in fact, both me and Richard interacted with a woman named Josephine Grace, who has her own website. But Richard actually went and visited Josephine Grace in her home. And Josephine Grace came to San Diego and met with Richard Schoengard and his daughter. She claims that she was being harassed in exactly the same way as Damien. And Richard and I talked about her a couple of years before he passed away. And she has a website called targetedartist.wordpress.com. And you can actually hear her tell her own story on Jeff Brady's radio show In Other News, which airs at a WBAI in New York. In fact, Richard Schoengard appeared as a guest on that show In Other News. So you can actually hear Richard Schoengard talking in his own words about Camellio. I'm glad that interview exists so you can hear him talking in his own words about it. If you go to my website, cryptoscatology.com, and just search for Richard Schoengard or Jeff Brady, G-E-O-F-F, I'm sure you'll be able to find the link. But Josephine Grace, she was part of an organization called the Missourians for Safe Energy. And in Fayetteville, Missouri, in the 1990s, she becomes a freelance newspaper journalist. And her beat was chemical and radioactive pollution. And she uncovered a mothballed nuclear power plant underneath the campus of the University of Fayetteville, which students didn't know about. So she blew that story wide open. At around the same time, she got a job at this huge corporation, and she had these work-related injuries. And she, when she reported the injuries, she notices she's being followed and eventually moves to get away from the constant surveillance. So she moves to Springfield, Missouri. And by the way, Richard Schoenkert grew up in Missouri. So there was that kind of a connection between the two of them in that sense. So she moves to Springfield, Missouri from Fayetteville, and she starts seeing all this stuff that's almost exactly the same kind of stuff that Damien was being subjected to. She starts seeing these eyes superimposed on the wall, and she claims that these people wearing invisibility suits, just like what Damien saw, started interacting with her, you know. And what's interesting, and I've heard this story several times from other people, that she claims that she's psychic, and she told me that she tried to use her psychic abilities to block out their attacks against her. Basically, they were using like non-lethal weaponry or electromagnetic weapons against her, just like they were doing with Damien. So that she, at one point, she tried to use her psychic abilities to block out their attack. And they were using the psychotronic technology to basically attack her inside her mind. So she claimed, this is her claim, she claimed that she threw up this kind of psychic shield, I guess you could say that, around herself to block them out. And the second she does that, she realizes that they're mapping out what's going on in her mind. They're mapping her brainwaves. So in other words, they knew she was going to do exactly that. That's what they wanted her to do. So they can map out exactly what's happening inside her brain at that moment and recreate her natural abilities synthetically, like for defense purposes. After all, that's the name of the game, right? You know, defense, offense, the Department of Offense, right?
I mean,
so
yeah, yeah, go on.
Well, this psychic kind of psychic component to the targeting comes up again and again among people who do not know each other and in fact feel very isolated. There's a story that comes up over and over again when I'm talking to some of these targeted people, that when they were kids, they were removed from their regular classes and put into special classes. But this wasn't like AP classes. These were different. Yeah, these were like very, very, very strange. And the teachers would do things like put their hand in their pocket and say, "Can you tell me what's in my hand? Can you visualize it?" In other words, they were like testing their psychic abilities when they were children. And when Tessa Dick interviewed me about Camellio, she told me, just completely unbidden, I didn't ask her about it, she brought it up entirely on her own, that she had been in a similar kind of class. And then what really stunned me is that she said that Phil Dick told her that he had been in a similar class. So Phil Dick was born in 1928. So let's say this happened to him when he was 10 years old. That's like the late 30s. So we're talking about this program going back to the late 30s of trying to find children who have natural psychic abilities. It makes a certain sense to me that Phil Dick may have been a part of such a program, because Walter Boart, who wrote Operation Mind Control, he told me back in the late 90s that when he read Valis by Phil Dick, his first thought was, is this guy a mind control victim? Because there were so many elements of Phil Dick's story in Valis that paralleled the people he had investigated who were victims of MKUltra. So it seems that there's, obviously, I don't, you know, Damien's not psychic. Or he's never claimed to be psychic. In some ways, he's anti-psychic. So I'm not saying that that's why they were targeting Damien. But in some of these other situations, it seems like that's what kicks it off. In fact, I talked to another woman who actually worked as a psychic. In other words, you would go to her and she would give you readings, you know? And so one day this woman comes in, older woman, with her husband, an older man, and they come in, and she could tell that the man was reluctant. He didn't really want to be there. And so she gives them both a reading, a psychic reading, individually. And so she talks to the woman, and then she talks to the man, and she says to the man, why would you come to a psychic after having gone to a top secret meeting with, and then she starts laying out specifics about the top secret meeting, this guy, and he was actually in the military, you know, but he hadn't told her that. He had just gone to some top secret meeting, and she starts laying out the details about it. And then she goes, it wasn't a really good idea to come to a psychic after having gone to a meeting like that. And he like turns white, gets really disturbed. He leaves. After that, her targeting starts, and she starts experiencing all the same.
What stuff
that Josephine Grace.
Yeah. What did they talk about in this meeting that this guy was before visiting her?
You know what? She didn't tell me the specifics of that. I mean, that'd be a good, I should like contact her again. And like, cause this was something she told me rather casually, you know, I would need to contact her and like go into more specifics about it. It was something that was very, you know, sensitive, intelligence review, and certainly something that he didn't want anyone else to know. And she wasn't giving out, you know, super specific details about it, but she told him enough that he knew that she was actually on the level, that this wasn't some sort of grift. Yeah. You know, so apparently he was convinced enough about it that he thought something needed to be done about it, or when he went back and told his superiors, this woman actually, you know, genuinely read my mind, they were like, oh, fantastic. You know, those are exactly the type of people we're looking for. And the whole, it seems like the whole objective is just like in the MyLabs where they re-abduct the alien abductee and then question them and say, what kind of craft was it? How was it piloted? You know, what can you tell us about the technology? Because of course the whole goal is to just like back engineer it. It's almost a similar thing. It's like, how do we back engineer this ability that these people have naturally? How can we artificially like induce that into our soldiers for defense purposes?
I often wondered sorry, I just want to say, I once read a quote, I don't know where this was, talking about invisibility tech and psychic warfare and all of that, there is a section in the Pentagon where they deal with remote viewing, UFOs, and mind control. What an odd mixture, but it does make sense, doesn't it? In a way.
Oh, yeah. There's a really good book called Psychic Battlefield by W. Adam Mandelbaum that came out, I think, in the late 90s or early 2000s. So it's more than 20 years old at this point, but it's a very valuable book, and you know it's well documented that the United States military is very interested in psychic abilities. That's not something that is in any way a controversial statement.
No.
they're obviously very interested in it, and they're interested in knowing how to utilize it for their own purposes.
Yeah, and it's not just remote viewing. I mean, there's remote influencing and all of that. So you just go right into freaking magic.
I sometimes wonder if you know how, I mean, according to Josephine, you know, they were interested in trying to replicate whatever was happening inside her brain, and if so. I even joke about this at one point, or I just throw out this kind of casual speculation in Camellio, that at a certain point, I think they started targeting Damien simply because he was not cooperating with them, and it pissed them off, and they thought he had information that they wanted, and he wasn't giving it to them. And it was as simple as that. However, I do think at a certain point, these people must have looked at each other and said, what the hell? How is this guy surviving all of this? How is it possible that a human being could withstand the assault that we're throwing at this guy? And see, I mean, that's been, I met Damien on my 16th birthday, and this is his superpower, is that Damien's like the most stubborn person on the planet.
Obviously, yes.
I can imagine. I can imagine these people like looking at each other and going, man, maybe, you know, how do we replicate this? this guy has no fear. You know, I mean, can we bottle this? Can we manufacture this and inject this into our soldiers? I mean, I was recently talking to Damien, and Damien told me how he was trying to take care of his ongoing drug problem. And he said he was reading up on literature on you know, addictive personalities. And he was saying, he said to me, he goes, it amazed me to discover that there are people who, when they think about doing something that's criminal or wrong or possibly self-destructive, that they actually stop a moment, they self-reflect, and they think, oh, if I do that, then there will be bad consequences in the future. Damien said, my brain has never done that. At no point. He said that that was a totally foreign concept to him, that somebody would like actually think to yourself, oh, wait, if I do that, I might get thrown in jail, or X might happen if I do that. Damien goes, my brain's never worked that way. I just always just spontaneously do it.
This guy is so amazing. How, I mean, honestly, how did he survive? I mean, how is he, by the way? I mean, last time we talked, he was not, that didn't sound good. He was urinating blood and stuff like that. And
he was not in a good situation.
Yeah.
Probably the last time I was on the show with you. Recently, I would say that I'm hopeful that he's turned a corner. As I mentioned in Camellio, it's a problem. It's already a problem if you are a lifelong drug addict. Then you layer on top of it that you're suddenly being assaulted by the U.S. military and used as a guinea pig. That doesn't help the situation in any way.
No.
And and sometimes I'm being interviewed about Camellio, and people will say, well, it sounds like he's a drug addict. Like, how can you believe anything he says? And I say, I'm the first to admit in the book that he's not a reliable narrator. And if he was the only source, I wouldn't have written the book, you know, but he's not the only source. You know, we have Richard Schoengert's testimony, Dr. Lev Berger, who's saying, yes, this science exists, this type of technology exists. I also had the woman I call Alita Johnson, the NCIS special agent who was investigating him. I spoke to her, and she told me, yes, Damien is a person of interest, and tell him not to leave town. So, you know, I had three sources, you know, confirming that this wasn't some figment of Damien's imagination, you know. Also, Damien's drug of choice is heroin, which is not a hallucinogen. You know, some people, like, they think all illegal drugs are the same.
Yeah.
You know, so I would say that there have been recent developments, and I think that Damien's turned a corner, and I really hope that he can get back on track, because I have in my possession a 130-page manuscript that he started writing at a certain point back in the early 2000s, where in the manuscript he starts out talking about when he was homeless in Washington, D.C., and then he got arrested and thrown into a prison in Maryland, where he served time with Mike Tyson. They were on the same cell block, because Damien's dad was a narcotics cop.
Yeah,
which there's all kinds of interesting ironies.
Yeah,
there. But because Damien's dad was a narcotics cop, whenever he was thrown into prison, they considered that his life was in danger. So he would always be put in the same cell block as whatever celebrity was there at the time. So like back in the early 90s, I remember he got thrown into LA County Jail, and he was on the same cell block as the Menendez brothers and O.J. Simpson. and then Boy. So then later in the late 90s, he gets arrested because he stole a car. And it's very complicated, but he served time with Mike Tyson. In fact, he remembered he was working in the library. Mike Tyson would come in and check out books about Islam. And Damien would check the books out to him. So he was in prison for, I think, a year. And then when he gets out, he goes to, not Wisconsin, but Minnesota, and he goes to Minnesota, which is where his son, he had a young son at the time, and the mother of his son was living, and then that's when he met this girl, and this girl was just like living in a van, and they get together, and her family's in San Diego. That's how he ends up in San Diego, because he met this girl who had family in San Diego. So he goes to San Diego, and that was like the most stable time of his life. I mean, he sold a couple of stories. He was getting a lot of stuff done. You know, he wasn't taking heroin anymore or anything like that. He was leading a pretty stable life. And then it was he and his girlfriend broke up, and that's where Camelio begins. Mm-hmm. But before that happened, he had started writing this manuscript that starts out with him being homeless in D.C. and all the madness.
So he's a writer as well. I didn't know that. Or I forgot about it.
Oh, yeah. And I what I would really like him to do is to write this whole thing from his own perspective.
Oh, boy.
It'd be like Rashomon, you know, because you have my account. But then it'd be great to get it from his perspective, and he could just pick up the manuscript that he left with me, which begins with him in D.C. homeless, and then goes all the way up to him moving to San Diego. But then the narrative stops there, because that's where he starts getting targeted, and he was not in any condition to be writing anything.
Yeah.
So I have this manuscript, and what I want him to do is just to pick up the narrative where he left off. If he picks up where he left off, could easily just segue right into all the stuff that happened to him in San Diego, and then everything, then he could take it all the way up to today.
Yeah.
And I think that would be a fascinating read.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
Well, Camelio, I mean, it was just writing Camelio and publishing it was kind of like putting a message in a bottle and throwing it into the ocean. Like, I had no idea who was going to see it or, you know, who would
read it. Well, it caught on. I mean, Jacques Vallée references, you know, so.
Absolutely. But also, like, I knew that other people were having these experiences. You know, I knew it. It's not just Damien. If they're doing it to him, it's being done to other people. And so it's been fascinating since 2015, kind of meeting some of these people face to face, interacting with them, interviewing some of them, and seeing how the similarities among some of the stories, you know, among people who are not interacting with each other.
Yeah.
And just like the story about the kids being pulled off into the special class. I mean, that's not an idea that is permeated popular culture. It's not something you would have picked up from a
absolutely fascinating, and it of course reminds me of Stranger Things and all kind of stuff. But
that's true. Also, Willie Strieber's Secret School kind of parallels that.
Yeah. Boy, we are coming at the end of our show. I mean, we are talking 2.5 hours now, which is time was flying by again. A couple of things I would like to get to. One of those, maybe. Did you hear anything of whatever happened at this Miami Mall in January 1st? Did you hear that, where people allegedly saw some huge creatures and there was mass panic, and it seems like almost the whole police force of Miami was in this mall because of something. Have you heard of that at all?
Oddly enough, I have not heard about that.
Okay. Well, well, Google it and tell me if that's not an application of that technology that we are discussing today. Honestly, I mean, it's... But either this is all completely made up and it's just an AI hoax. I have no idea. Or...
That's fascinating. This is Miami in January of this year?
January 1st. Miami Mall. I
said, oh, okay.
I forgot which mall it was, but I can maybe show you, send you some information. Vladislav Raab did some stories on that and he collected stories. And there were lots of people who saw those creatures coming out of a portal. And you can't make this up. And I have no idea. Either this was just a freaking psyop and we are completely in QAnon land or whatever, or aliens or whatever creatures appeared there through a portal, or it was some kind of test of exactly what we are talking today. I think it was the latter, but I have no idea. Or it was
That's
just
fascinating.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I just thought I have to ask you that because that was really something, if it was something at all. One of the quotes that I also noted is one of your quotes is keeping UFOs secret is obviously a violation of the First Amendment.
Oh, yes. Well, I think that was actually, that's something that Walter Bohr.
Oh, boy. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Would often talk about. I think he mentions that in his
researcher's
edition.
Yeah.
Of Operation Mind Control. He did a revised researcher's edition in 1994, and I think he introduces that idea there about it being a violation of the First Amendment in the sense that if the National Security Act is preventing us from knowing of actual advancements in technology and science, it's actually preventing you. It is a violation of free speech in the sense that it's preventing you from knowing what to talk about.
Yeah, you can't talk about right? relevant stuff if you don't know what the relevant stuff is. If you're just getting fed bullshit all day, then I totally agree. I totally agree. Yeah, it is.
Right. I remember one time I heard Richard Hoagland on Art Bell, and he was talking about he had seen some sort of news segment. Occasionally, you know, mainstream newspaper reporters will go out to Area 51 or S4, you know, and they'll actually capture some kind of bizarre, you know, UFO activity. And there was this one guy, they had some reporter out, and they actually capture on camera something flitting about in the night sky over Area 51. And the reporter said something like, huh, I wonder how much this is costing us. And Richard Hoagland said, like, that was his main concern, is how much is this costing us? Like, in other words, you're acknowledging that there's some sort of technology that the U.S. government has access to that violates all the laws of known physics.
Yeah.
And is several decades or hundreds of years in advance of what we think we know. But your first question is, how much is this costing us? Yeah. Yeah. The implications are far more dramatic than that.
Yeah, they are.
And I mean, Walter and I saw something very similar when we went to retrieve Gabriel Green's archive. It took us all day. We're out in the middle of the desert in Joshua Tree, not far from Giant Rock, where all the UFO people used to meet back in the 50s. We spent all day getting what we could of Gabriel Green's archives into Walter's van. We spent all day there. We didn't have time to drive back. So Walter says, why don't we just camp out in the desert? So we did. And we drove out in the middle of the desert. And off in the distance, you could see the lights of 29 Palms, the military base. Walter standing there smoking a cigar. And I'm standing there next to him. We're looking at the stars. And there's a star above the base that seems to start moving. And at first I thought it was like sometimes if you look at a star long enough, it appears to be moving, but it's not. So at first I thought that's what it was. But then as we kept looking at it, it started like swaying back and forth. And then eventually it just started like moving about like a firefly. But it was way off high up in the sky. And
it reminds me of Tic Tacs, actually. And you tell the story already in the last show, but yeah, it the way you describe this, the way it moves very erratically, it reminds me a bit of a Tic Tac. Yeah.
And what we saw was very similar to what this reporter was talking about over Area 51. I mean, I saw the footage of the reporter. It was very similar to that type of thing. And, you know, that guy's first thought was, I wonder how much this is costing us. And my first thought was, well, you know, is this extraterrestrial? If so, are they here because they're drawn to the military base, or is it above the military base because it's a military aircraft and they're experimenting with it? You know, is it maybe it's neither of those things. Maybe it's not extraterrestrial, you know. Coincidentally, that was the same night I heard John Keel was on Art Bell that same night. which was a weird coincidence, because I actually called into Art Bell back in like 1997, and I managed to get through. It was the one time I ever attempted to call into Art Bell, and I got through the first time.
Wow.
And I suggested that he have John Keel on as a guest. And at first he said he didn't know who that was.
Wow. And then I said, it's, yeah, you told me that. Yeah.
And I said he wrote Mothman Prophecies. And then when I said that, he said, oh yes, I have a copy of that right here. but he didn't have him on until 2001 2002. It was January 2002. And so whatever night that was that John Keel was on Coast to Coast, that was the night that me and Walter Boart saw the UFO over 29 Palms.
What a night. What a night. And talking about Art Bell, I mean, we talked about that on the phone before a couple of months ago. I mean, his death, isn't that strange how that all went down? I mean, suddenly a guy turns up. So he just does this new show, and it was great. I loved it. I was back in the 90s, listening to Art Bell every night. It's just best thing ever. And then suddenly a guy turns up in his yard with a gun, threatening or frightening his wife and daughter, and then he suddenly goes off the air. Bang, he's gone. And 2 years later, he dies. Of an overdose of medication, right? That he probably took, like, I mean, he always had back problems. Like, that was a constant theme. So he was on this medication forever, but suddenly he doesn't know how to use that anymore. I mean, what are your thoughts on Art Bell's death?
And he was only, how long was he on? How long did that new show last?
Maybe half long. A couple of months only. And
yeah,
I mean, he had one guy on who would start talking about, yeah, some aliens he met in the supermarket and stuff, and he would just stop the interview right there, like, okay, yeah. I mean, he was at his best. I mean, he had a guy on talking about flat Earth with Tyson, the physicist. You know who I mean? Tyson, is it named Tyson? Well, anyway. So he had a guy on talking about flat Earth, and it was amazing. I mean, stuff like that. I just loved it. Neil deGrasse Tyson discussing a guy who just had the epiphany like 6 months before that the Earth is flat. I mean, can you imagine this interview? 2 hours? I was sitting in the corner of my room shaking. That was one of them.
I recently had the thought, and this is similar to a previous thought I had. I was walking down the street one day, not far from I was coming home from teaching class, and the thought suddenly appeared in my mind, somebody should write a biography about William Cooper. And my next thought was, I should write a biography of William Cooper.
Yeah, you should.
And then my next thought was, my next thought after that was, I don't want to write a biography of William Cooper. I'd rather read someone else's biography of William Cooper. It's literally about just a couple of days later, I'm at Barnes & Noble, and I see in the biography section, it's a new book, a hardcover, Pale Horse Rider by Mark Jacobson. Mm. I know who Mark Jacobson is because back in the early 90s, Mark Jacobson wrote a novel called Gojira, which was like a surreal version of Godzilla. And Mark Jacobson also wrote, he wrote a series of articles that was then turned into the sitcom Taxi, starring Andy Kaufman, back in the 80s, right? So I knew who Mark Jacobson was, and I hadn't seen a new book from him in many years, and suddenly there's a biography of William Cooper by Mark Jacobson. I thought, this is amazing. It was almost like my mind had manifested. Like I said, somebody should write a biography of William Cooper, and then like a week later, it came out. And so I read it, and I actually highly recommend it. I thought the book was going to paint William Cooper as kind of, a villain, and instead, I think it's actually a rather balanced view of the man. And I highly recommend it. And so it wasn't long after that I thought, oh, someone should do a biography of Art Bell. And then I thought I should do that. And then I thought someone else should do that. But actually, unfortunately, in this case, it did not then manifest. It didn't work. It wasn't like with the William Cooper book where it suddenly, boom, manifested in reality. There still is no Art Bell biography. But that is a project that would be absolutely worth doing.
I would love that. Oh, my God. That would be, yes. Please do that.
There are so many fascinating rumors that swirl around him that are not confirmed. It'd be interesting to try to track them down.
Oh boy.
And also it's such a dramatic story arc, the rise to prominence in radio and then all the dramatic things that happened while he was on the air. It would just be a fascinating narrative.
I mean, just the guy who flew into Area 51 and called him while doing that. I mean, yeah, okay. So
there's also, by the way, I recommend this to anyone who was a fan of Art Bell, no doubt remembers Mel's Hole.
Yeah, Mel's Hole, yeah. Oh, God.
So a few years back here at Fullerton College, I think it was Fullerton, I'm looking through, I think it was the LA Weekly, and I see a notice for an art show, an art exhibit that's coming up at the University of Fullerton. And it was the Mel's Hole art exhibit. It was a whole series of artists who did paintings and multimedia and all kinds of not just paintings but all kinds of different forms of art inspired by the Mel's Hole story.
Yeah, inspired by Art Bell. I mean, I think this guy had an immense influence. I mean, this show wouldn't exist if I wouldn't have been hooked on Art Bell's during the late 90s. I mean, completely hooked. I was listening to this guy every day of the week, 4 hours. It's, I mean, via stream, which was real audio then. So it was really strange. You were sitting there like 100 years after the invention of the radio, and it sounded worse than when it was invented. But anyway, what are your thoughts about Art Bell's death? Do you have any yet, or do I have to wait on the book?
I'd have to wait and actually look into that. It's an interesting question. I definitely would love to look into that in greater detail. It's an intriguing question. I'll say
absolutely
that.
Absolutely. I mean,
and I absolutely completely agree that there's. I mean, I think about all the podcasts that exist now that grow directly out of Art Bell. I mean, a lot of these people grew up listening to Art Bell. Now they're doing their own thing. Just like Art Bell heard Long John Neville York.
You turned me on that guy, and I listened to a lot of stuff of Long John. I mean, you can find some of his shows. Brilliant. I mean, yeah, it's talk radio. Talk radio is the thing, in my opinion. It's still great. So,
and the key thing is that Long John Neville was on at night, all night. Like, it would start like at midnight.
Yeah.
And he'd interview Ivan T. Sanderson or John Keel or Orfeo Angelucci for like 3 or 4 hours.
Yes, he did. he did the thing. I mean, yeah, Long John Neville obviously was the culprit of it all. But yeah, I was drawn into arts world, and lots of people who are inspired by him. No one gets close, though. No one. I mean, it's just the way he talks, the melody of his speech. It's just mind-boggling. And the guests, of course. Now, back to the reality. I really wonder what Art Bell would have... I would so love to hear an interview, Art Bell interviewing David Grush. And he would have interviewed him. No question about it. Or? I think
sure.
He, yeah.
Sure.
So...
I have to say, one of my reactions to Art Bell's death was semi-selfish in the sense that it would have been great to have talked to him about Camelio, you know.
Oh, boy, yeah.
Camelio.
Boy.
Yeah, Camelio came out in 2015. And when did he start the new show? Wasn't it around the same time?
2014-ish, something like that.
Yeah, right. So it was just like a year before.
Yeah, it was the time.
Camelio came out. It would have been great to talk to him about that, you know. So part of my reaction to his death is, I guess, a selfish one.
Totally understandable.
Yeah.
I wanted to write him a mail like for decades, and I always thought, okay, now he's retired, now I'm going to write his mail. And then I started it, and then he died. Anyway, David Grush. Let's cover also this one. As we were talking about UFOs a lot tonight, and as the world's gone crazy on UFOs since 2017, we didn't cover on that last time. What are your thoughts on this whole thing? I mean, you have like Chris Mellon and other high-ranking ex-intelligence people who are suddenly going to tell us the truth about UFOs.
Well, it's interesting. I guess my main... concern about all that is there was an article that was published in I'm trying to think now if it was the Atlantic, I think it was the Atlantic, very long article, it was about 13,000 words. I'm trying to remember the exact title of the article. I can't remember it off the top of my head, but in the article at one point the reporter is talking about how the entire way that all this got started was that Skinwalker Ranch, there was a particular politician who wanted to experience Skinwalker Ranch.
Harry Reid? Could it be Harry Reid?
It was someone connected to Harry Reid, but wasn't Harry Reid himself. Harry Reid had passed along this person to Bigelow and said, well, here's the guy who can hook you up. And so it was this military official who went to Skinwalker Ranch and saw this bizarre phenomenon, like hovering in the air. It was making like weird geometric shapes in the air. And it was that experience that convinced this person to advocate to open up, you know, a new, almost like a new version of Project Blue Book, right? To investigate UFOs, UAPs. And when I read that, my first thought was, having gone through all this stuff with Damien, I know that what he observed could easily be mimicked by this kind of technology.
Yeah.
And so my skeptical brain kicks in, and I immediately wonder, you know, was he shown something on purpose to convince this guy to initiate a new investigation into UFOs that would then unlock the deep pockets of the black budget, so that now the whole point of this technology, basically the whole point of this research, is the weaponization of space. And just like I was it's talking about the psychic research. It's always about, you know, how is this going to help defense? How is this, how can we make super soldiers out of this? Or how can we do, you know, it's always about warfare, and it's always about making a lot of money. And so the skeptical part of my brain wonders, you know, is the interest in all of this really just a ruse to unlock a lot of money in the black budget so we can spend a lot of money on trying to weaponize space? I guess that would be my main concern. Otherwise, you know, obviously it's good that more attention has been brought to the subject. But very often it's kind of like, it's similar to when I hear people being interviewed about investigations of the paranormal, you know, or investigating ghostly phenomenon, is I'll hear kind of academics talking about, well, we're going to bring in our cameras and we're going to capture this stuff on video, and then we're finally going to get evidence, you know, for this. And I always think that they're kind of missing the point that this kind of phenomena is not something that can ever be nailed down or locked down on video cameras. It's Fritz Leiber, the horror writer, Fritz Leiber, fantasy science fiction horror writer. He wrote a story called A Little Bit of the Dark World back in the 1960s. And in that story, it's about this group of paranormal investigators who go to this house that's purported to be haunted. And they go there and they each have notepads. And whenever they see something, they each go individually and write down what they saw. And then they compare notes, because they quickly realize that this is a subjective phenomenon, and that four people can be standing in a room seeing something, and they're all seeing something different. Or maybe one person doesn't see anything at all, you know, and the same is true of the UFO phenomenon. So I think it's good that more attention is being paid to it. At the same time, I wonder if UFO investigations can ever be locked down with traditional views of physics and science, if it doesn't occupy a different realm, perhaps more a philosophical or metaphysical realm. I guess that's my main concern, is that is this being used as merely as a way of finding and creating new and better types of weapons? That would be my main concern.
It's for sure on creating new and better types of weapons, or surprising weapons. I mean, as we already said in the last show, the guy that brought us together, interestingly enough, is Chris Marks. And he went into some strange venue by then. I know you also heard about that.
Well, he was arrested.
He was arrested.
he was recently arrested.
Recently?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't know if you know the update or not.
No.
But I guess it's worth going into, because in a way this kind of ties back to what we were talking about at the beginning, when I was talking about Jerome Corsi, and at around the same time that my five-part series about QAnon had just finished appearing on Salon, Chris Marks calls me to talk about Camellio. So, you know, he at that time is married to Erica Lukes, who is a podcaster, and she does a podcast called Expanded Horizons, or is it Expanded Frontiers? I'm forgetting.
Yeah, and she sued him for domestic violence. And they're divorced again, yeah.
Yes. So Eric is the one who asked him to read Camellio. And we spoke for about 2 hours. And it certainly seemed like he read the book. He gave me the impression that he was very interested in getting the truth out, You know, he told me he saw a man shapeshift into a wolf on Skinwalker Ranch,
yeah,
and all these other strange phenomenon. And at one time, he believed that these bizarre occurrences were supernatural. You know, and but then after reading Camellio, he said he was stunned by how many parallels there were between Damien's experiences and everything he experienced for 5 years on the ranch. Now he's on the phone telling me that everything he saw might have been a result of the same sort of optical camouflage technology that Richard Schoenger created. So maybe he was telling me the truth about all of that, but we remained in communication after that via email. He went out of his way to get me booked on this show. And so he seemed to be going out of his way to, you know, gain my trust, certainly. And then the last time I communicated with him was like just a few days after January 6th, 2021. Then in September, he gets doxxed along with a lot of other military and law enforcement officers. He gets doxxed as a secret member of the Oath Keepers. Right. So you come to find out that at the same time he's talking to me on the phone and getting me booked on this show, he's threatening to shoot, quote, left-wing motherfuckers, unquote, and ranting and raving about assaulting Obama and Biden. And he said, you know, I have no issues taking a gun and starting shooting left-wing motherfuckers at the rallies.
Yeah, that is, it's shooting at protesters is a no-go, period. Shooting at student protesters is even worse. But then saying I'm just going to shoot at left-wing student protests, I think that's what he said, is just mind-bogglingly off. You know, it's like, no.
What's fascinating to me is that he tells Erica that she records it on November 13th, 2020. That's about 3 weeks after we spoke on the phone. Okay, so I was in communication with him at the same time. And so I have to, my suspicious brain kicks in, and I have to ask, like, what was the purpose of gaining my trust? And was that purpose cut short by the doxing? Why did he decide to target Erica Lukes? Was it because of what she was saying on her podcast about Skinwalker Ranch? Did someone want to keep very close tabs on her?
Whole thing was an op, even, I mean, including marrying, because they got married, Erica Lukes. And
that's not unprecedented.
Yeah, right? It's still, wow.
There's a Guardian article that was published in June of 2014 called Why I'm Fighting the Met in Court Over Undercover Relationships. And here's a woman who identifies herself only as Allison. She writes about a 6-year-long relationship she was duped into having with an undercover police officer who, while hiding behind this false identity, infiltrated an organization to which Allison belonged. And the organization was, it says, an independent political group that exposed police corruption in the early 90s and promoted trade union anti-fascist politics, unquote. So at the time the article was published, at least 8 other women were taking legal action against the Metropolitan Police for having been victimized and manipulated by these same types of covert agents. And what's interesting is that the Utah National Guard did nothing except close ranks around Chris Marks, even though he had threatened his fellow soldiers, and Erica had filed several charges against him for domestic violence assaults, and he violated the protective order, so he was arrested and charged with a felony, which was then dropped to a misdemeanor. He was put on 2 years probation. He failed to appear in court when he was supposed to. Erica's friends and colleagues were harassed and threatened. And now it's important to note that Chris is a former deputy sheriff. So it's interesting that law enforcement kind of turned a blind eye as long as possible. And the investigator in charge turned a blind eye. Some cases weren't even being filed. And then at the beginning of April of this year, Chris Marks committed another domestic assault, not against Erica, against someone else, and was taken into custody. And so he got bail, but then he went back to the residence of the person he assaulted. And then there was a manhunt, and he was arrested and jailed and deemed a threat to the community. So as far as I know, he's...
Wow.
I guess he's still in jail.
Oh boy.
So, but I'm relating this back to what I started out talking about in regards to Jerome Corsi sliding in on the Reddit thread and feeding information to Radix, who's then putting out all that information on her Patriot soapbox about QAnon. It's almost, I'm asking the question, is it possible that Chris Marks was trying to gain the trust of not just me, but like anyone who Erica knew, to feed them information? You know, you gain their trust, then you feed them information, and then they start promoting that information. But is it possible that that whole op was cut short by the fact that he got doxxed along with like all these other law enforcement and military people, including the sheriff of Riverside out here in California? In that same doxxing incident, it turned out that the sheriff of Riverside was also a member of the Oath Keepers, and he had to come out and make a speech, and he said, oh, you know, I didn't even know I was a member of the Oath Keepers. And anyway, goodness. I don't know what the Oath Keepers are.
Okay.
And then he said, he goes, and the Oath Keepers, people say that the Oath Keepers are like a far right wing, you know, fascist militia group. No, they're not. And it's like, wait a minute, I thought you said you didn't know what they were. So you don't know what they were, but you know what they're not? How is that possible? And then he said he didn't even know that he was a member. So I guess he like joined in his sleep or something. But that, you know, there's a lot of military people, former military people, current police officers who were involved in January 6th and who are super into QAnon. And there have been numerous articles about this, and I wrote about this in The Silent Civil War that's on the Evergreen Review, and I also wrote about it in Operation Mindfuck. There's a disturbing amount of cops who are really into QAnon, and a disturbing amount of military people who are into it as well.
Yeah, but I mean, what I have to say on the other way around, because when I was interviewing, I even asked this question a little bit jokingly in the second interview I think I did with him, that he was actually into counterintelligence. He talks about counterintelligence operations he did on Skinwalker Ranch, I think fooling those people with lasers or something like that. I don't know if he told you that as well. So I told him, maybe, I mean, am I now part of a counterintelligence operation? Am I spreading, you know, disinformation? And he, of course, he says no. But I think, but on the other hand, I still think that the stuff he told, I think he gave an honest account of what he encountered on Skinwalker Ranch. What's your feeling about it?
Well, you know what? It's important not to jump to conclusions.
Yeah.
You know, I'll often hear people talk about, for example, Philip Corso, Colonel Philip Corso, who wrote The Day After Roswell, and they'll point out, for example, if you read a book called The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell, which is a nonfiction book that came out in the early 90s, it's about the JFK assassination. Mm. It's a pretty good book. I recommend it. In that book, he talks about Philip Corso. Now, this book came out before The Day After Roswell, which comes out in 97, right? This book came out in the early 90s, and it talks about, you know, Philip Corso was an early, back in the 60s, was promoting the idea that JFK was killed by like a cabal of communists, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so Philip Corso was definitely like hard right wing, you know. And then people will say, well, he was like a far right winger, anti-communist. He must be lying in The Day After Roswell, therefore.
Hmm.
But the one thought does not logically follow the other. In other words,
no, I agree. Yeah.
If you want whistleblowers to come out, you know, for the most part, what type of people are going to have access to this information? You're going to get a lot of military people who tend to lean towards the right, you know. So if someone's going to come out of that world and start talking about that stuff, naturally they're going to be probably hard right wingers, you know. I mean, that's the milieu out of which they're emerging. So, you know, a fascist can see a UFO as easily as somebody else.
Yeah, sure. And he can right? tell the truth about it. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So it's like one. It's important to be aware of these things and that there are political agendas, and that when these people come out, they might have a political agenda. But at the same time, it doesn't necessarily logically follow that therefore they are lying.
Exactly. So I mean, time flew. It was very fascinating. 3 hours. We had, and coming to the end, you mentioned in the last show, you mentioned the book called Hollywood Haunts the World that you are writing. I'm really looking forward to that one, and I think that would, at the latest point, we should do the next show when this book is out. But you also sent me a great article on Jack Kirby, who is, I mean, it's mind-boggling what this guy invented. I mean, the X-Men, I think Spider-Man, I mean, pretty much all of the major comics that came out in the last comic movies that or superhero movies that came out in the last couple of years seem to go back to Jack Kirby. So that also seems to be a great show. So I'm really looking forward to your next oeuvres that you will put out. You just sent me Dead Monkey Rum. I read into a little bit, so that's a fictional book, and I'm really looking forward to that one as well. And yeah, so
Dead Monkey Rum, by the way, was nominated for a Rondo Award for best. It didn't win. It did not win, but it was nominated for the 22nd annual Rondo Awards. And Dead Monkey Rum is about the evolutionary theories of this visionary artist named Stanislaw Sokolsky, who actually existed. There's a Netflix documentary called Struggle that's all about the art of Sokolsky. And it's about Sokolsky, it's about cryptozoology, tiki culture, pissed off abominable snowmen, the South Seas, rum, talking monkeys, and secret underground tunnels in LA, and all kinds of other high strangeness. Alan Moore, the author of Watchmen and V for Vendetta, gave it a blurb and said it's a remarkable rush of entertainment and thrills. It was a great fun to write, Dead Monkey Rum. So I definitely recommend that. And that came out late last year. And then early this year, I have a short story collection called Cryptopolis and Other Stories, which was published by Lethe Press.
Oh yeah.
And it has 25 short stories I published over the course of about 23 years from 2000 to 2022. And a lot of the stories have Gnostic, Hermetic, alchemical, Masonic, Kabbalistic themes. There's two of the stories, Cryptopolis, the title story I wrote between the second and third degrees of the Freemasonry, and the ninth story of the book, Initiation, I wrote right after the third degree of Freemasonry. And there's a story in there called Bring Me the Head of André Breton, which is about it's like my meditation on the connections between UFOs and surrealism. And there's a story about the JFK assassination, and there's stories that were based on dreams and all kinds of amazing things.
Yeah, stories.
I'm very proud of it.
Yeah, stories based on dreams. That's interesting. So a lot of things that came to you in dreams and that you then worked out and yeah.
Yes, that's my most recent book, Cryptopolis and Other Stories.
Cryptopolis.
And in Jack Kirby Collector number 89, which is the most recent issue, the spring 2024 issue, I have this article called G-Bomb, Masonic and Hermetic Symbolism in the Incredible Hulk, which analyzes the esoteric symbolism and the works of Jack Kirby. And And yes, the cinema book, Hollywood Haunts the World, An Investigation in the Cinema of Occult Taboos, is going to be published by Het Press in England sometime either later this year or early next year. And I also have that covers 100 years of cinema from 1921 to 2021. And I also have another novel coming out this year called The Expectant Mother Disinformation Handbook, which if you're interested in conspiracy theories, you're going to want to read this. That's what I have going on.
So Hollywood Haunts the World, did I hear you correctly, should come out later this year or
either later this year later. Or early next year.
Yeah.
Not sure yet.
Yeah. And I think that would be a great show, especially in combination with all the work that you did on comics. I mean, we didn't mention The Invisibles, which is a very interesting comic series that I don't really know it, but I heard a lot about it. I'm sure you know it, The Invisibles.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Coincidentally, that's the title of chapter one of this book by Steve Richards.
I know, yeah. That's why I thought about it when you mentioned it. That's why I took the note. So comics and the surreal and the paranormal and whatever, big connection there, and obviously Hollywood. Yeah. So lots going on, I guess, and I'm very much thank you for this fascinating evening again. I mean, I really enjoyed it, and I hope to being able to welcome you again.
Oh, it was a blast, and I would love to come on again anytime.
All right, then. Yeah, have a good day in Long Beach. I hope the weather is better than here, but you said it's rainy as well.
Well, it looks like it might start raining, but hopefully it'll clear up later.
Yeah, it rained the whole day here. But anyway, okay.
Okay, great.
Then thanks and talk to you.
Okay, good night.
Bye-bye.
Crop FM.
You are far from home, baby. Baby.
Ja, und in der nächsten Folge, in genau 2 Wochen, da gibt's ein weiteres Crop FM Lagerfeuer. Crop FM Lagerfeuer Nummer 14, Sabine Zankolo. Und ich freue uns auf eure Beiträge, Erlebnisse, Erfahrungen und Fragezeichen. Zu hören ist das Ganze am 17. Mai 2024. Ja, dabei sein, ihr macht das Programm. Und mir bleibt nur mehr, mich zu verabschieden. Danke fürs Zuhören und fürs Interesse. Und heute spiele ich mal wieder eine Nummer aus dem neuen Luxusalbum The Future Still Lies Ahead. Die habe ich, glaube ich, noch nie gespielt. Sie heißt Theme 4. Ja. Bis zum 17. Mai. Macht es gut.